and yell. I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to drink this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on our Future Friday. Terrence Heath's going to be here talking about Romney and the economic policy of the 1%. Something that, you know, look, you know what where Romney's allegiance lies. It lies to his cronies. It lies to the folks who, who made him the $250 million man. That's where the allegiance is, not to you, not to me, not to working people, could care less about us. I'm going to talk about that. Jeff Garris is going to be here, field director for the Pennsylvania Voice. We're going to talk about the voter ID bill ramming its way through the Pennsylvania Senate today. Again, you know, another one of these pieces of legislation where you go, Alec inspired, Alec driven, paid for by the 1%. Why? We don't want people like you voting. We don't want poor people voting. We don't want disabled people or elderly people. No. We just want, well, you know, like the Constitution, white landowners. That would be a good way to go back to it. And I wish they would just come out and say that. Let's just go back to that, because that's really the whole argument that the originalists want to make. We want to go back to the original intent, which... It takes us back to women. Sorry, you're second-class citizens, as we're seeing from all of the rhetoric. But we'll talk to Jeff about the voter ID bill. Also in the second hour, Charlie Fleming, president of the Georgia AFL-CIO, going to be here talking about the Georgia bill that basically criminalizes, you know, people and pretty heavy fines for folks who engage in civil disobedience. And again, it's amazing at how fast this thing came about. The people at Occupy Atlanta and Jobs with Justice there in Atlanta and some working people decided, you know what, AT&T, we're not thrilled with what you're doing. We're going to protest. And they went and protested a week later. Now there's a piece of legislation basically criminalizing that and with some pretty stiff fines and penalties. We'll talk to Charlie Fleming about that. And in the third hour, Sophia Edwards is going to be here. She's a striking worker. She's one of those people who sticks you with the needle, which is kind of a little weird. People with needles scare me. I hate needles, and I don't know why. It's not like it hurts. I just hate needles. But the folks at Red Cross are on strike. Look, Red Cross made something like $2 billion in profits last year from blood collections, from the work that these folks do, and they want to cut their benefits. They want to cut their staffing levels. They want them to work longer hours. And somebody was just telling me the other day they're working like 14, 16 hours now without a break. That's insane. It's unsafe. We'll talk to Sophia Edwards about that as this strike continues. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, has Lint Ball gone too far this time? I'm sure folks have heard the news by now. He called the woman who came, the law student from Georgetown, called her a slut. And, you know, everyone's upset, and as rightly so. It's a dumb thing to say. He was an idiot. And, well, really, is there any surprise in that? And my initial reaction to this is, why are we surprised? Why is there outrage? We should just ignore him. And my original thought was just kind of ignore it, which is why I haven't dealt with it until this point. But now I'm starting to see a lot of these Republicans popping out of the woodwork going, whoa, I think we've stepped on something here that could awaken people. And they don't want that. They want people to be, you know, going through their lives kind of tuned out, just staying on the treadmill. They don't want anything to make them pop their head up and go, what's going on? Because they've done that to my wife. She's kind of popped, you know, very non-political person, always has been. Now popping her head up going, wait a minute. What exactly are you talking about? And she used to be a Republican, which is kind of interesting. And she's looking at the party going, weird, too far. And the question is this it? Is this where it's gone too far? Calling this college student who was talking about a friend needing medical treatment, is that too far? Calling her a slut and telling her that she needs to have less sex, is that finally too far? I mean, the assaults on workers, was that not enough? The assaults on the elderly and the poor and children, is that not enough? The assaults on voting rights, was that not enough? Is this finally it? I mean, the rape bill in Virginia, wasn't that enough? All these ultrasound bills that Alec is, that's not enough yet? I mean, there's part of me that goes, how much more honest can they be? How much more do they have to show their hand before we wake up and go, yeah, they want to take us back to the 1880s, 1890s. They want us way back there where workers were second-class citizens. They were just tools to be used and discarded. Women weren't even that much. They were just there to help the tools. And when the tools got killed or injured, you know, the whole lot was thrown off of the company property. I mean, how much more? How much more do we have to see the game plan? How much more do we need? Because it's the billionaire class who wants to take us back there. Because they, right now, they haven't had it so good since then. I mean, they want to go back to those days where they had ultimate power, where they didn't have to, you know, walk on eggshells with what they really believe. And I think they're starting to think that, well, they're emboldened completely to say all of the insane things that they've been talking to each other about. So I'm kind of in that spot. Where from here? What's the next thing that they can show? What's the next shoe to drop? How much more do we need to know about these people who want to leave the country? How much more do we need to know about them? And I look at the final four, if you will, the last four dwarfs that are left of the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. How much more do we need to know about them? They've been completely vetted. And there's part of me that thinks in the convention, they're going to have to spring somebody else, somebody we don't know yet, someone who can step and say, you know what, all of that stuff you guys have been focused on, those people are nuts. Santorum's crazy. Romney's just, who knows what Romney is. Gingrich, well, we'll send him to the moon. And Ron Paul, well, he's good for a laugh. There's part of me that thinks that has to happen for this party to even have a chance in November. And I look at what's going on in Michigan right now. Evidently, Michigan decided, and one of those things that makes you go, what's the point in going to the polls and voting? The Michigan Republican Party decided that they were going to allot the two delegates from the state that evidently have to be awarded on a proportional basis. These two at-large delegate votes are supposed to be, you know, based on the popular vote. Originally, they were supposed to be split, so the 30 delegates, 15 would go to Santorum, 15 would go to Romney. Well, the party has changed its mind. The Republicans have changed their mind, and they're going to award both of those delegates to Romney. So now it's Romney gets 16, Santorum gets 14. And the more you look at this stuff, you go, well, you don't even trust your own people to vote. What are you going to do with everybody in the general? What happens when they have total control? I mean, we've seen example after example after example that they can't govern, that they don't have a plan, they don't have an idea. But you see this thing in Michigan and you go, they can't even run a simple primary vote. And then you go back to look at Iowa. Look at the mess that was Iowa, where we didn't know what they changed it a couple of times. And Santorum won. No, Romney won. Oh, wait, Santorum maybe. I don't know. And look at Maine. I still don't know who won Maine. They still haven't counted that. And Ron Paul's right. Maybe he did win. And we want these people to run our government? You want them to represent us? I mean, I remember Wisconsin, that Supreme Court race they had there with that Posner guy, where originally they thought the Democratic woman won. It was by a handful of votes. And then, oh, gee, this woman from Waukesha, Wisconsin. I just took home 14,000 votes in my laptop. Just took it home. Oops. I mean, really, what more do we have to see? How much more do we have to know about this party? How much more do you have to know about Republicans to know that they're inept? They cannot lead. They cannot do what we need them to do. All they can do is continue to feed the billionaires and be the puppets of the investor class. I mean, how much more do we need? Really? I mean, it's amazing. And you got Romney running around, and I love Romney because you never know where he's going to be. One day he's here, next day he's there. He's all over the map. So he's been running around lately saying, well, you know, I saved the Olympics single-handedly. I was Romney man. I got my R cape on and flew into Salt Lake, and I saved those Olympics. And you got Santorum going, well, yeah, you saved an Olympics with federal money. And he's going, well, no, you know, hey, you know, we did what we had to do. You're kind of trying to step away from it. Playing this well, I'm an outsider. I'm not someone from Washington. So the big news of the day for Mitzi. Well, let me just play the clip. I mean, it's listen to this. Hold on a second.
I'm a big believer in getting money where the money is, and the money is in Washington. And I've learned from my Olympic experience that if you have people that really understand how Washington works and have personal associations there, you can get money to help build economic development opportunities. I want to go after every grant, every project, every department in Washington to assure that we're taking advantage of economic development opportunities.
Yeah, just like he did when he was with Bain, and just like he did when he was with the Olympic Committee. He knows where I know where the money is. I'm going to go after every grant. Big believer of getting the money where it is. And it's in Washington. And he got a lot of money. And, you know, it's amazing to me. If you listen to the rhetoric, you listen to them talk, oh, well, we don't want any of that. We don't do any of that stuff. And what I find kind of bizarre is that there are people on the right who look at all of them and either call them hypocrites for their position on earmarks and federal money, or believe that they're never going to take it. Understand, the job of a congressman, the job of a senator, the job of a governor, and it sounds like I'm defending Romney, but I'm, and to a degree I am. Look, you want to do what's in the best interest of your state. You want to do what's in the best interest of your congressional district. You're fighting for their interests, and it's going to help you get elected. Understand the game. And I think a lot of people don't realize how this whole system is set up. Agree or disagree, you're going to vote for the guy who makes your life better. And Romney knew where the money was, and he played the game and played the system. But what I find amazing is he's denied it from the beginning, denied it, and now this comes out. So how much more down the road are we going to get? And I love this, all this opposition research they're doing on each other, because they're all just, like I said, 1,000 paper cuts, which leads me to believe that I think the convention is going to be one of those moments where they go, these guys are just all damaged goods, and we need to go somewhere else. And I'm hoping it's not Christie or Jeb Bush. Maybe Bobby Jingle Jangle Jindal. Maybe he would be a good choice. Or there are a number of folks out there. But these four, wow, mind-blowing. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future. Going to talk a little bit about Mitzi's, about his economic development plans. Government money, I guess. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Arizona AFL-CIO Thursday organized a day of action at the state capitol in Phoenix against six anti-worker bills pushed by right-wing Republicans. Several busloads of union members and supporters carried their message to politicians at the Arizona capitol. Arizona AFL-CIO spokesperson Rebecca Friend says corporate politicians are pushing these bills, scapegoating working families to fulfill their extreme right-wing agenda to the detriment of schools and the health and safety of Arizona communities. Police and firefighter unions are among those opposed to these bills. The anti-union bills are being backed by the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity. The bills attack public worker unions as part of a nationwide assault on the rights of public workers in a calculated strategic move designed to destroy not only the on-the-job rights of public workers, but their power to fight back politically as well. The former director of security at the Upper Big Branch Mine will serve 3 years in federal prison. Huey Elbert Stover was sentenced for lying to federal agents and destroying documents sought by investigators probing the 2010 disaster that killed 29 miners in West Virginia. The case focused on Stover's role of giving the mine advance warning of safety inspections, which allowed cover-ups of bad safety practices. Mine Safety and Health Administration investigators said that played a major role in the disaster at the mine, formerly owned by Massey Energy. Will Connecticut's minimum wage soon be close to $10 per hour? Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, Connecticut minimum wage workers earn $8.25 per hour, which comes to roughly $17,000 per year for a full-time minimum wage worker. According to the federal government, the poverty level for a family of four is $22,350 in total annual income. That number has been used by advocates of raising the Nutmeg State minimum wage to $9 per hour in 2012 and $9.75 per hour in 2013. According to the legislation seeking those increases, the state's minimum wage would be tied to inflation starting in 2014. A study presented during recent hearings on the bill found that there is no correlation to the claim that increases in a state's minimum wage leads to job losses. Connecticut is one of 18 states that has a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country. And over the past few weeks, we've seen a frontal assault on free enterprise.
Once I'm made you rich enough to forgive my name in Youngstown.
Well, maybe prosperity for all in his clique, especially when he, well, like he said.
I'm a big believer in getting money where the money is, and the money is in Washington. And I've learned from my Olympic experience that if you have people that really understand how Washington works and have personal associations there, you can get money to help build economic development.
Yeah, you can get money if you know how to work the system, Mr. Outsider says. Amazing, amazing stuff. And, you know, I thought when the whole Cayman Islands money and the Swiss bank account and all the money he was hiding, when I thought that came up, I thought he was done there. You got to go, how many lines does this guy got? Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. So it is our Future Friday, and I've got Terrence Heath on the line from the Campaign for America's Future to talk about Romney, this insanity of his economic development. Which is, I don't want federal money, but, oh, I know where it is. Terrence, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me on.
The height of hypocrisy or just being honest?
This is being met, to be perfectly honest. Like I wrote yesterday, as a matter of fact, Mitt Romney has one absolutely unshakable, immovable conviction, and that is that he should be president. And everything that he says and does is in service of that one core conviction. That's why he's had to run away from his record, as a Massachusetts moderate in a party that is seriously putting its political capital into yet another culture war fight that they are destined to lose, at least in terms of public opinion. It's mystifying to watch it happening, especially with someone like Mitt Romney, until you understand that that his basic bottom line conviction is that he should be president, and he's going to do and say whatever it is that he needs to do, that he thinks he needs to do to get the nomination of a party that still can't decide that it wants him.
Yeah, and the other part of it is what I find pretty interesting is and it appears to me he is working so hard to try and convince me or you or working people across this country that he somehow liked them. And I would respect him more, and I've said this before, if he just came out and said, look, I'm a rich guy. I don't know what your petty problems are. And to be honest, don't care. I want to make your lives as good as mine. I would respect that.
And that's something that people would probably tune into. I mean, just given the way that people, that Americans look at it, whatever people feel about inequality, Americans still have a bit of a soft spot for wealthy people because they think someday they may be one. Some people call it the lottery effect.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ever going to hit the lottery because I've never actually played. So
yeah,
it's kind of hard to win when you never play.
I've never bought a ticket.
Yeah, because the truth of the matter is I work too hard for every dollar I make to throw it away
on a
gamble.
Like every single one of us does. And I think if he used that message, you're right, he probably would do a lot better, but he doesn't seem to be able to help himself.
But it seems to me that the Republicans want him. I mean, look at what just happened today, and the news just came out from Michigan today that they've changed the allocation of the delegates from 15 apiece to 16 for Romney and 14 for Santorum.
Right.
And you go, it looks like the backroom party deals are still being made in his favor.
Because they've got to get a nominee. And at this point, it's down to Santorum, Gingrich, or Romney. And when those are your choices...
Jindal starts looking pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. But you've also got to keep in mind, in just this week, the names that have been floated to potentially enter, and I'm not even counting anything that happened before, that was said before this week, Bobby Jindal, his name has come up as someone who could possibly get into the race.
And Jeb.
Jeb Bush, another name that has come up at this stage in the game. And with the ink on her letter of resignation to the Senate not even dry, Olympia Snowe's name has also been mentioned as a potential 2012 bid. So when you look at it, I'm sure that in some smoky back room somewhere, people have sat down and said, we got to get a nominee. We have to have a nominee. And this is the best we're going to be able to do.
I got to be honest with you. If we end up in the convention and they come up with anyone other than one of these four idiots.
It's going to be a mess.
It's going to be hysterical. But then you have to feel sorry for the four idiots who have spent well over a year now beating the tar out of each other.
Exactly. And by the way, making a fairly good case against whoever does happen to be the nominee, because as I've been writing in this series that's on our website, Republicans Exposing Themselves, the longer this contest goes on, what you begin to realize is how much these guys get right when they attack each other.
Yep.
They nail each other, and you can go back and look at some of the stuff that I've posted that. The things that they say about each other are absolutely right, and whoever's going to be doing the attack ads for the 2012 campaign, a lot of their work has been done for them.
Yeah, all their opposition research is done. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Some of their ads have even already been made.
Yeah, I'm sure. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. You know, one of the questions that I was going to ask you is, you know, you look at this thing with Limbaugh, And you look at how the Republicans are kind of just running away from him right now. And I asked the question earlier, how much more of their hand do we have to see? How many more different cards have to fall out of their hand before we realize that they really hate us? I mean, you go after workers last year, you go after women's rights, you go after, the whole, poor people, the elderly, students, you name it, they're targeting them. How much more do we have to see of their hand that they want to take us back, 100 years? Before we wake up to the reality that this party is clearly broken?
I think the contraception fight is one of those things that makes it painfully clear. I've spent the last couple of weeks watching this unfold and literally asking, really? You guys want to, this is what you want to do. this is what you want to spend your time on, or your time arguing. But you have a party that has spokespersons like Rush Limbaugh, who not only said the outrageous remark about the young woman this week, but made an astounding remark last week in which he distinguished between mothers and women who use birth control or contraception. And I thought, I'm pretty sure I could walk down the street and ask 10 women who happen to be moms, and who aren't necessarily lesbian moms, I guess, if they use contraception. And most of them, I'm willing to bet, probably do. Because it's an economic issue for people.
Absolutely.
As well. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of married couples who use contraception to avoid having more children than they can afford, as well as young women like the woman Rush Limbaugh was attacking, who for a number of different reasons want and need to have access to contraception. It's something that's a no-brainer to, I think, 98%.
But what it highlights to me, Terrence, is the reality that while the Republicans up to November 2010 told us it was all about jobs, tells me two things. One, it's not about what they keep telling us. And two, they don't have a clue on how to fix the economy or do anything else. All they know is attack and division.
And when you look at their economic plans, the four Republican candidates, none of them go anywhere near fixing what's happening with the economy, let alone creating jobs to the deficit to the national debt. I mean, even Mitt Romney, in the past week or so, when he was trying to score a win in Michigan and poured $4.3 million into beating Rick Santorum by 3 points, changed his economic agenda, threw his old economic agenda out the window, as David Frum said, and I quote, he said, compassionate conservatism has been dead for a while. Mitt Romney's campaign basically sets fire, his latest agenda, economic agenda, sets fire to the Remains. It's not only going to cost jobs, but it's going to explode the deficit. It would explode the national debt, and the numbers don't add up.
Yeah,
they just plain don't add up.
Right, but that's why he came out with a 59-point plan, because he knows nobody's going to read it.
Right. This one was 4 pages. The new one was 4 pages. and it doesn't work, and all of their plans have been scored. And in every single one, in the case of every single one of them, it just doesn't work. There's fiscal conservatism is thrown out the window in these economic plans. It's a frightening picture of what could happen if any of them had an opportunity to inflict
their will and cause the punishment and pain that we know is coming. Look, all the studies are out there. The UK does a ton of these studies. When conservative government takes over and you have these cut, gut, and punish people leading the country, you have more pain, you have more misery, you have higher suicide rates. All of the negative socioeconomic things that happen cause massive destruction to the family. And these are the people who are telling us that they're the family values people.
And the people who are telling us, go ahead.
I guess we're buying it, or at least I hope we're not.
The people who are telling us that we're on the same course, the same road as Greece, that we're becoming like Greece, are the very people who are proposing policies that will ensure that's where we end up. That would make us something like Greece. Simon Johnson and Paul Krugman both have pieces that point that out. That would lead to much larger debt, much larger deficits, massive, massive cuts. Mitt Romney's new budget proposal would throw something like 10 million more people, additional people, into poverty. So let's see, that brings us to something in the neighborhood of 57 million.
That's good for business, Terrence. Cheap labor.
Well, one of the things I did point out kind of half jokingly in my piece is that yes, Mitt Romney's budget would deprive the government of something like 6.2 trillion in foregone revenue. But when you get to when you get to how much he would cut, you're looking at probably about 6.5 trillion in cuts without the budget amendment. And actually, if you throw in the balanced budget amendment, that's 10 trillion in cuts to everything, you know, except non-defense spending. So you actually would end up with a surplus under his budget, but a very painfully won surplus.
Yeah, but it's still there. And see, you get those lazy people, you know, all those people in wheelchairs and all those old people. Get them back out in the workforce. Get them selling grapes or oranges on the corner. It's good for the country. Good for the good for the moral fiber.
Right.
I'm really looking forward to the convention.
I am too, because I don't think that this is something that, honestly, they're going to be able to sell. At some point, people, A, are going to be tired of hearing about their culture warrior agenda, because it's a losing battle for them on a number of fronts, and they're going to have to come out and say, this is what we want to do, and this is how it's going to work, and they can't.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. If you want to read Terrence Heath's piece, go to ourfuture.org. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Terrence's name, and it'll take you to his writings. Terrence, it's always great talking to you, brother. I appreciate
your time. Thank you so much.
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know, I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
You thought that yesteryear's threat of creeping communist cells inside the USA was the worst conspiracy in our history? Or maybe you think that foreign terrorists pose the greatest threat ever. Well, get ready to be whopper-jawed, Americans, for it turns out that the most insidious assault on the very fabric of our nation is coming from within. From a radical and subversive organization dedicated to warping the minds of our children. Yes, that devious group is the Girl Scouts. Luckily, though, our nation has such alert patriots as Bob Morris to warn that the Girl Scouts are coming. The Girl Scouts are coming. Bob, an Indiana Republican legislator, recently drew a bright line in the political sand by being the only member of that august body to withhold his signature from a resolution celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. It seems that Bob found allegations on the Internet that these supposedly innocent cookie-peddling kiddos are really a tactical arm of Planned Parenthood, promoting casual sex, the homosexual lifestyle, abortion, and, worst of all, liberal progressive politics. And in case you're one of those fact addicts who don't believe everything on the Internet, Bob offers this damning proof of the girl group's perversion. First Lady Michelle Obama is honorary president of this, quote, radicalized organization. This, he warns his fellow Republicans in a letter, should give each of us reason to pause. Never mind that Laura Bush previously served as honorary president. This is Jim Hightower saying, in bleeping credible. Only, this bobblehead of right-wing BS is not alone. At least one extremist church outfit is asking members to pray against the Girl Scouts, claiming that these kids' cookie sales amount to blood money. Well, let's just all pray that Rick Santorum doesn't discover this conspiracy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
I love this country. I should love this state. It just feels good being back in Michigan. You know, the trees are the right height. The streets are just right.
There is trouble in the forest, and the creatures are happy. As the maple seems refreshing, and the oaks just shake their heads.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com, where the trees, well, the trees are all different heights here. Not just the right height, they're the wrong height sometimes, too. Really tall, really short. He does that a lot, though. I mean, if you listen to the Romney enough, he does a lot of that rambling. I like. Trying to really get people to think that, oh, he's like me. I like trees, too. Or, you know, I like amendments. Because that was funny, too. Oh, I like the First Amendment. Oh, I like all the amendments. They're my favorites. I love amendments. Oh, funny story today. Evidently, Gingrich was on the stump, and someone made a remark about the vault. Because if you remember not too long ago, he said, well, I don't want a vault because you can't put a gun rack in it. Well, someone took that as a challenge and decided, hey, I'll put a gun rack in the back of my vault, which he did, and it held three guns. So now being, you know, proven to be wrong, he says, well, you know, we can't have the gun rack. Well, where are you going to put the dead deer? Where's that go? Because, you know, a friend of mine says, sure, maybe you could put that gun rack in there, but where's the dead deer go? And I think you could probably get one of those little racks to put on the back, and I'm sure someone's going to do it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the next guy who goes, hey, see, Newt, you're wrong again. I like Newt. You know what I really like about Newt is the whole, I cheated on my wife because I love my country so much.
Partially driven by how passionately I felt about this country.
I just love my country. And that's how I ended up, well, we were walking down the street and I tripped. And she tripped and it just happened. You know, every week for about 3 years. And I tried that. I asked, I'm sure a lot of guys were like me and went home and said, what do you think, honey? And she said, no, not happening. You'll find your stuff on the curb. And I know my wife would. She would leave me the junk. She'd take all the good stuff. Anyway, yesterday the president renewed his call for cutting some $40 billion in subsidies to the oil industry. And that couldn't be left out there. We had to have John Boehner to the rescue. Big Oil John defended the $40 billion in subsidies by citing a March 2011 Congressional Research Service study that claimed gas prices would go up without the big handouts. Well, a more recent analysis of the Congressional Research Service in May of 2011 found that there is little reason to believe the price of oil or gasoline would go up if we ended the studies. So, you know, they kind of looked at it again and said, well, you know, maybe not. I mean, the subsidies we're giving them, they're putting right into their pockets. Now, understand, they made $137 billion in profit, the Big Five, back in 2011. The subsidies that we give them would not have, or should not have, raised the price at all. And you look at the Bloomberg report. From yesterday, Bloomberg News came out with a study, with a report that said, look, if we do the Keystone XL thing, because, you know, Boehner and the rest of the Republicans, you know, full bore, keep pushing this ridiculous notion that somehow if we continue to drill, baby, drill, it's just going to, the price of gasoline is just going to fall through the floor, which is on so many levels just insane. And it's insane that anyone would believe that. But, Rick, you don't understand supply and demand. Yeah, I do. And I understand that if we drill 1% more of the world's oil, it's not going to matter very much because it's all what we drill here ends up in the international system. It's not like we're drilling it here and keeping it here. If we were to do that, I'd be in favor of drilling a little bit more, which we've been doing wildly for the last couple of years. But according to the Bloomberg News, they say that the $4 billion every year that we give to ExxonMobil and all the rest of them. They say that the higher crude prices would erase the discount enjoyed by cities including Chicago, Cheyenne, and Denver. So if we build this pipeline, it could cost us, you know, a boatload more money, because evidently we're getting discounts for being in those regions, and they're doing some refining, and that's where the drilling is. If we do this pipeline thing, everything goes down to Texas. It's refined. It's shipped out of the country. So they're actually saying, according to Bloomberg, that it could actually raise the cost of gasoline at the pump. And I find that pretty interesting. Because then you look at it, you know, Boehner has come out and said, well, you know, if we take away these subsidies, we take the handouts away, it's going to raise prices. But yet he's supporting the Keystone XL thing that people are saying it's going to raise the cost at the pump. So in Boehner's world, we give the XL pipeline, it raises the cost, and we continue to give the $40 billion in subsidies. So the oil industry not only makes $137 billion, next year maybe they'll make $200 billion. At least that's what it seems he's saying. And I look at the facts, and the facts are, is, you know, we are actually using less foreign oil than we did during the Bush years. 2005, 60% of our consumption was imports. It's down to 45% now. And you look during the Obama years, it fell from 57 down to 52, from down to 49, down to 45. Why? Gee, I wonder why. Oh, could it be that we're drilling more and that there are more rigs being in place now than there were during the Bush years? In fact, there are more rigs here in the U.S. than in the rest of the world. Could that be? If you read that Houston Chronicle report not too long ago, they laid it out. The number of rigs have exploded the past 3 years. And in fact, U.S. crude production is rising at levels not seen since the 40s. So this nonsense that the Republicans keep throwing out, well, Obama's standing in the way. You got this John Cronin, this Republican from Texas, saying, well, the single biggest obstacle to our domestic energy production is the Obama administration. And you got to know, because Obama wants, as Gingrich said, the 999 plan. He wants Obama to make sure gas is $9.99 a gallon, which is ludicrous. But, you know, they keep throwing this out there because their talking heads pick it up. The Energy Department confirmed that the U.S. has more oil products than they imported for the first time since 1949. We're exporting more than we're importing. Why? Because we're doing the smart thing. We're conserving. We're moving to alternative energies. We're getting people off the oil. We're CAFE standards. We're moving towards cars that are more fuel efficient. Even the trucks are more fuel efficient. Sounds like a smart thing to me. But if you listen to the righties, man, they're losing their mind. And it's the frame. Not even in reality. And this is the thing that gets me. And maybe it's the media, maybe it's our education system, I don't know. But what we hear someone utter on the radio, we tend to take as, well, he said it must be true. They keep saying, well, we're not drilling. Yes, we are. We now have more holes in the ground than anywhere in the world. Explain to me how that's not drilling. We're actually shipping stuff out of the country. Why? It's an international market. As I've said a million times, I would be for the Keystone XL pipeline if it went to Chicago. And if we said, you know what? We'll do like Romney said. And, you know, I agree with Romney to a degree. You know, let's get that oil because, you know, we deserve it.
He rejected the Keystone pipeline. I'll get us that oil from Canada that we deserve.
We deserve it, that's right. We deserve it. Because we're Americans, damn it. And like I said, you know, don't just cut my country in half and ship it overseas. I want it to stay here. And I think that's pretty simple. Pretty simple premise. But you know, the Republicans won't go along with it. Why? Because they're in the pockets of the oil companies. It's pretty simple. And you look at the billions of dollars that they're pocketing in our subsidies. At some point, you just got to stop it. Just stop it. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, I'm working all the time. It seems to me I could live my life a lot better than I think I am. I guess that's why they call me the Gunny Working Man.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
The sun is now in an active part of its 11-year cycle of activity. Many dark sunspots are visible to those using telescopes and solar filters.
Space observatories are detecting brilliant solar flares, intense bursts of radiation, and our solar system's largest explosive events, lasting minutes to hours on the surface of the sun.
Occasional powerful coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are being released. They are giant bubbles of gas and magnetic fields from the sun, containing up to a billion tons of charged particles. This solar material sometimes strikes Earth. Is it dangerous? Should we be worried?
The answer, say scientists, is no. These solar storms are awesome to contemplate, but they're not dangerous to us on Earth's surface because we're protected by Earth's blanket of atmosphere.
On the other hand, very high-energy particles, such as those from solar storms, would be dangerous to unshielded astronauts in space. Solar storms can also disrupt satellites in orbit and bathe high-flying airplanes with radiation. They can also disrupt telecommunications and navigation systems.
The current solar cycle, called Sunspot Cycle 24 by space physicists, is expected to peak in February of 2013. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Solar Storm. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do to encourage housing? One is, don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom. Allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, you listen to Romney there, and that's the investor class mentality. Let it bottom out. Let the investors come in. Buy it up cheap. Rent it back to you at top price. Yeah, that's the way to go about it. Let the investors get in there. And you look at the fact that 11.1 million homeowners, or 22.8%, of folks who have mortgages are underwater with their mortgages, according to the latest data. And you go, that's a huge amount. How do you, that settlement may help a million. What about the other 10.1 million? What do you do for all of these folks who are basically screwed? And I look at Super Tuesday coming up. The states across the country, you got 10 of them, Alaska, Georgia, Idaho, Massachusetts, North Dakota, Ohio, which I'll be in for Super Tuesday, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Vermont, and Virginia, all going to have their primaries. And you look at the ones, you look at Georgia, for instance, the fifth highest rate of people underwater. A third of all of the people who have mortgages are underwater. You look at Idaho, 25% underwater. You look at Ohio, 24% underwater. Virginia, 23% underwater. And you go, is that going to play, to the folks in those states? This, if you're underwater, we're going to let you sink. We are going to let you drown. Nearly 23% of the people who have more, screw you. Investors can come in, buy those houses up, we'll rent them. You won't even have to move. We'll rent it right back to you as is. I mean, that's the mentality. And the question then becomes, where do you go with this? I mean, the reason Obama hasn't done anything is the Republicans have been standing in the way. And the other part of it is not bold vision, in my opinion. Had he come in and said, you know what, from the beginning, this is what I want to do. And look, you know, the problem with him is, and it is a problem, and I think he's coming around to the realization of how this game is played. You come out with really bold ideas and push the envelope as far as you can, and then you settle for what you had wanted. Anyone knows that's basic table negotiations. You know, if I want a dollar an hour raise, I'm going to come in and say I want two. If I want, extra cheese on my Whopper, I'm going to say I want twice as much. Which is why when you came out with this plan, you should have come out and said, look, you know what, we're going to do like Roosevelt did during the Depression. We're going to set up the Home Ownership Loan Corporation where folks who are struggling can come. We're going to give the banks a haircut. We're going to bring down the principal. We're going to give a long 30-year mortgage at a set rate. Everything's going to be above boards. And they did that back then. And what happened? Well, what happened is people paid their mortgages. What happened was the government made a small profit at the end of it, and it was closed off. But what it did on the bigger picture is it stabilized the housing market. So you didn't have as many people underwater. What it did was it left communities intact. So you weren't tearing down houses, and you didn't see all these dilapidated buildings that have been gutted, where you have charter schools who send their parents into the school. Hey, rip out the copper pipe so we can get some money to buy books, like down in Florida. And what you needed to do from the beginning, and I know they're trying, but you needed to go after these criminals. You needed to go after these big banks, and you needed to hold them accountable. And I saw a report today from the from Reuters saying that the Justice Department is casting a wide net and looking at these mortgage brokers. They're issuing a bunch of subpoenas again because they're looking for stuff, and it's about time. Because the SEC, they looked into it, and they've been looking into it, and there have been a slow trickle of convictions and people going to jail. This is a wider net saying, hey, we're looking at more stuff. And the industry is losing their mind. Well, we should have the indignity of the thing. We shouldn't have to give them information. We shouldn't have to tell them how we screwed the country up. Shouldn't have to do it. And, you know, what I was looking at the numbers of documents that the SEC had looked at, something like 25 million pages of documents. And you go, at some point, you get all this stuff, and you need more. So we're seeing more investigations. So I'm happy to see that there's something going. I got to be honest. I'm happy to see that somebody poking these big banksters with a stick. At least something's going on. But the reality is we've got to be the ones that hold them more accountable. And that means leaving them alone. And the report I saw today is that the credit unions last year added 1.3 million members. And I said, well, that's an awful lot. It should have been more. I mean, on bank transfer day, they said something like 400,000 people left. About 30% of all the new customers were because of that. And it was because of Bank of America saying, hey, we're going to gouge you for $5 on your debit card. And there was just a report the other day that Bank of America has got a whole new list of charges that they're going to be rolling out in a couple of states to see, you know, kind of what kind of reaction they get. Some people are saying the day of the free checking account is done. Unless you bank online, which you were seeing a lot of people pushing towards the online thing. But I'm interested to see where these fees are going to be, because of course they're gonna hit the young folks, they're gonna hit people who pay their bills on time, they're gonna hit folks who don't have an awful lot of money, and that's where these banks live. They live on charging you huge amounts of penalties and fines for this, that, and the other thing. And now mark my word, we're gonna see $5-$10 a month checking accounts. We're going to see the reemergence of the yearly fee for credit cards. And there's part of me that goes, you know, I'm not against that. I would love to see people going back to using cash again. I'm not a huge fan of the credit card or the debit card. And yeah, go ahead, charge people for it. See what the free market does to you. Because we saw what happened the last time when they decided, well, we're going to charge you $5 to use that little debit card to get your money. And look what happened. People got upset. And they actually organized it. I thought after the collapse, I really thought that when people found out about the derivatives and they found out about the bundling of the mortgages and all that, that we would see some organization around breaking these banks up, holding them accountable. And there's part of me that thinks maybe it was just too complicated or the banks were too good at sending out their minions. Because you saw the right-wing think tanks immediately. You saw the right-wing media immediately go after, well, it's the law. It's the government that made us do this. Because they made us give loans to those poor people. And you would be amazed at how many people I talk to who say, well, we all know why the housing market collapsed. It was those poor people who took out loans and couldn't afford it. It was those people who were in over their head. They weren't smart enough. When the reality is you look at Florida, for instance, where they have million-dollar condos that are empty. Why? Because the people who had jobs at one point lost them because everything started to collapse. Who gave them those loans? Oh, yeah, it was those banks. Wasn't the government. The government didn't force them to give loans to the millionaire class. You know, when I thought about paying off my house, and my wife and I worked quickly to pay off what we could, everyone said, no, your house, you leave that heavily mortgaged. And the conventional wisdom of the financial institution, and it still may be, is that you hold a huge mortgage because you could deduct part of that, and you know it's a liability and all this nonsense. And you take that money that cash that you would have paid your house off with, and you invest it, you gamble it on Wall Street, in things like mortgage-backed securities and these bundled mortgages. And look what happened when we followed that mentality. I mean, in this nation, when we thought about doing business in a smart way, we thought about running our lives like rational folks, like fiscal conservatives. When the Republican Party had some, they don't now, but when they had some, they understood you pay for things. We want roads and bridges, we got to pay for things. And if that means raising revenue somewhere, we did that. What we then got into is the Romney world of leveraging and deciding, well, we could take out a second mortgage to buy something else, and a third, and second mortgage that, and second mortgage that, and set up this whole house of cards. That's really how we got here. We convinced middle-income, upper middle-income folks that, hey, you can leverage just like the Bain Capitals, and you can leverage just like the big corporations, because we're going to give you all this money because we know that the asset that you're buying, well, it's worth this, and we can easily sell that. That was the collapse. That was the cause of all this problem. Not a handful of folks who lived in the inner city who got a couple of $1,000 loan to buy a house and to put down some roots and try and save their communities. No, it wasn't that. In fact, those people actually paid their loans back at a higher percentage than the general public. But you never hear the righties talk about that. You never hear the megaphones of the mega rich talking about that, do you? No, of course not, because it doesn't fit the frame. Just like, hey, we're a net exporter of energy. That doesn't fit the drill baby drill frame. Quick break, right back after this.
As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Arizona AFL-CIO Thursday organized a day of action at the state capitol in Phoenix against six anti-worker bills pushed by right-wing Republicans. Several busloads of union members and supporters carried their message to politicians at the Arizona capitol. Arizona AFL-CIO spokesperson Rebecca Friend says corporate politicians are pushing these bills, scapegoating working families to fulfill their extreme right-wing agenda to the detriment of schools and the health and safety of Arizona communities. Police and firefighter unions are among those opposed to these bills. The anti-union bills are being backed by the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity. The bills attack public worker unions as part of a nationwide assault on the rights of public workers in a calculated strategic move designed to destroy not only the on-the-job rights of public workers, but their power to fight back politically as well. The former director of security at the Upper Big Branch Mine will serve 3 years in federal prison. Huey Elbert Stover was sentenced for lying to federal agents and destroying documents sought by investigators probing the 2010 disaster that killed 29 miners in West Virginia. The case focused on Stover's role of giving the mine advance warning of safety inspections, which allowed cover-ups of bad safety practices. Mine Safety and Health Administration investigators said that played a major role in the disaster at the mine, formerly owned by Massey Energy. Will Connecticut's minimum wage soon be close to $10 per hour? Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, Connecticut minimum wage workers earn $8.25 per hour, which comes to roughly $17,000 per year for a full-time minimum wage worker. According to the federal government, the poverty level for a family of four is $22,350 in total annual income. That number has been used by advocates of raising the Nutmeg State minimum wage to $9 per hour in 2012 and $9.75 per hour in 2013. According to the legislation seeking those increases, the state's minimum wage would be tied to inflation starting in 2014. A study presented during recent hearings on the bill found that there is no correlation to the claim that increases in a state's minimum wage leads to job losses. Connecticut is one of 18 states that has a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right-wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
We found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it will probably fail, but our machines don't leave no paper trail.
The billionaire. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So on Monday, there's a group called Project Our Vote. They're a coalition of more than 40 organizations who are opposed to the Pennsylvania version of the voter suppression bill. Monday at the state capitol here in Harrisburg, 11 a.m., they're going to hold a press conference, rally, however you want to characterize it. Going to have some speakers there. One of the organizers, I've got Jeff Garris. He's a field director for the group Pennsylvania Voice. Statevoices.org is their website to come talk to us about what's going to go on Monday and House Bill 934, the suppression bill. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Rick.
So I look at this House Bill 934 passed through the House, pretty much a party line vote, the Republicans all in favor of it. Now in the Senate, what's going on?
Well, you know, it was almost along party lines in the House. There was one Republican who took a stand for voting rights and voted against it, and that was Representative Chris Ross. But other than that, it was a party-line vote. It moved over to the Senate. It was voted on in the Senate State Government Committee back in December. By a single vote, it was moved forward. It's in the Appropriations Committee now, and we have been told that the Appropriations Committee plans to vote on this on Monday afternoon.
And the rally is going to try and convince some folks. What do you think is going to come of that?
Well, you know, we're going to be demonstrating the broad and deep opposition to the voter suppression bill, House Bill 934. We will be presenting some petitions. We will be unfurling them and unrolling them, literally. We have about 12 to 13,000 Pennsylvanians who've signed this petition in the last couple of weeks. We have a continuous sheet of paper with all of those on. It's about 3 football fields in length that we're going to roll out in the rotunda. We have a number of speakers from a variety of organizations who will be speaking, and then we'll be going and delivering to each senator the petitions that were signed in that senator's district.
Yeah, I look at that, and it sounds great. It's great organizing, great getting people together and doing this. But there's part of me that says it's kind of a waste because the folks, the Republicans, are going to vote for it because it's a lockstep party, and that's what worries me.
Well, I have to tell you that if they had everything down for this the way that they would have liked to have had it down, this would have been passed a while ago because this was passed in the House back at the end of June. It was over in the Senate. There is a lot of reservation among some of the Republican members of the caucus. We've been told that all of the Democrats are solidly opposed to it. That's 20 right there. We've had a lot of our organizations. There are 45 member organizations in Protect Our Vote, and there are a number of other allies who've been working on this. We've had constituents meeting with their senators. By our estimate, there are at least 10 Republican senators who have serious misgivings. We think there are several that are likely to vote against it. I will point out that Senator Stuart Greenleaf from Montgomery County and Bucks County voted against similar legislation back in 2006. So we think that it is not a done deal, and hopefully they will represent the people who are their constituents.
I sure hope you're right. Let's talk about 934 for a second. Exactly what's the premise? I mean, I'm assuming from what I've read, it looks exactly like most of the other ALEC-based legislation across the country. Just, you know, the same voter ID nonsense that would not stop voter fraud at all, because I don't know that it exists.
Right. And apparently, according to our Secretary of State, Carol Achill, yesterday in a Senate Appropriations Committee hearing with her regarding the budget, she was asked several questions, and apparently she does not have any evidence of voter identity fraud in Pennsylvania. She was asked point blank by one of the senators, and she stated, "We don't have reports of it," and then tried to say, well, that would be something local district attorneys and local judges of elections would handle. And, you know, they're really busy people, and they have a lot going on. But, you know, the Secretary of State in Pennsylvania, who's advocating strongly for this, is saying that they don't actually have any reports of voter identity fraud.
Yeah, but we need to be just to be safe. But for me, I look at this, and the benefit, the payoff of doing what this law says it wants to stop, there's really not there. I mean, the punishment far outweighs the benefits of one more vote. I mean, like when we were in New Hampshire, up there, you lose your voting rights for life. Why would somebody want to cast one extra vote with the possibility of losing your vote for the rest of your life? It makes no sense.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, you know, if you think about it in realistic terms, you know, if one were going to try to commit voter identity fraud with the intention of changing the outcome of an election, the scale and the scope that you would have to do to make an impact is just unbelievable. You would have to have an army of people who are going to be prepared to go to multiple polling places where they might be recognized by the poll workers, who often know the people who vote in their polling places. You got the possibility you might be recognized. Then on top of it, we already have identification requirements in Pennsylvania. Every voter has to sign in, and that signature is compared against the signature that they have from the registration cards. So you'd have to have an army of people who knew how to accurately forge multiple people's signatures, not get caught by poll workers who might happen to know the voter, you know, to even begin to have an impact. And you think about it, how are you going to keep that many people quiet? It's just ludicrous. And, you know, Secretary Achill said yesterday, well, this is so that people can really have confidence in the election process. And then she tried to cite, you know, well, you know, like in the aftermath of Bush versus Gore.
Whoa,
people have to have confidence in this. But I'll tell you what, the thousands of Pennsylvanians who are going to be deprived of their right to vote by this legislation, this is not going to instill confidence in those people in the election process.
Well, if I wanted confidence in the vote, and I do, I'd want you to count the votes if you're going to use Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, well, I think that was an attempt at some perverted form of bipartisanship to reference that one.
Yeah, because I look at this and you go, this is going to cost something like $11 million that we don't have. I mean, if you really want to make the argument, we don't have the money for this. We're gutting education. We're gutting higher education. We're kicking granny to the curb. We're doing all of this really nasty stuff and using money that we really don't have for
right.
No real reason.
This is going to be unnecessary. It's going to be expensive. And it's going to deprive American citizens of their right to vote.
And I think that's the whole reason for it.
Well, I think one can connect the dots and look and see, and try to figure out what's going on. But you're right. This legislation, as you mentioned earlier, looks very much like the legislation that the Exchange Council, has circulated. And it's not surprising that one of their card-carrying members, Representative Daryl Metcalf, was the one who introduced this legislation. I will point out that he introduced the legislation 1 year ago this Sunday. They are going to try on the anniversary of its introduction to see if they can get this passed.
Yeah, there you go. I would like to see somebody put forth some legislation. If you really wanted to, stop voter fraud, if you wanted to stop fraud in our elections and give me some confidence, Jeff, in the whole process, I would say making it a crime for people to robocall and say, hey, we moved the elections to the third Tuesday of the month, or, hey, elections have been moved to Wednesday, or, hey, granny, don't worry, your polling place has been moved. I'd like to see that made a crime.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, if you're talking about stealing an election, voter identity fraud is the least effective way to steal an election. If you want to steal an election, the way you steal an election is you say the corporations are people and allow them to dump unlimited amounts of money without having to be held to account for it. That's how you steal an election.
Excellent point. The other part, if you want to steal an election, you put everything on an electronic voting machine, which I'm still against.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other argument for another day. Let me ask you the last question I've got for you, because a lot of my right-wing friends, they say, well, what's the harm? What's the harm in having to show your driver's license? If you know who you are, what's the harm of, because you got it in your wallet, what's the big deal?
Here's the thing, is that for those of us who have photo ID, those of us who drive, who have driver's licenses, this even crosses party lines, frankly. If you ask people who have ID, should you be required to show ID when you vote? It sounds like, yeah, sure, why not? But for folks who are on the margins of our society, for folks who are senior citizens who no longer drive, this is going to deprive them of their vote. And so I think that this actually breaks down a lot more along class lines than along even party lines. It's not a question of, is this going to keep you from voting? The question is this going to keep American citizens, your neighbors, your friends, your family members from being able to vote? And this is absolutely going to do that. And we haven't even touched on the long lines that are going to form out of polling places when poll workers, for the first time in a high turnout presidential election, have to start carding people who probably haven't even heard that they're going to need this. The lines that are going to form, you're talking about other citizens who are going to be deprived of their right to vote because they're not going to be able to stand in line for an hour or 2 hours when they try to go vote on their lunch break.
Well, one would argue that benefits a certain one party over the other, especially in a state like Pennsylvania, where one party has such a huge voter registration advantage.
Well, right, and you have to look at it too and say, who are people who do not hold valid driver's licenses? Well, if you live like I do in Philadelphia, or if you live in Pittsburgh, or you live in any one of our other large cities where you have public transit. And frankly, it would make a lot more sense to be riding public transit than to be owning and operating a car. You're talking about this having a disproportionate impact on urban dwellers. You're talking about it having a disproportionate impact on people of color. You're talking about it disproportionately affecting, senior citizens. So who is this going to benefit? you know, that's a question I'll leave to others to draw a conclusion. But, you know, this is going to hit particularly urban areas where there are not nearly as many people who are drivers and hold driver's licenses.
So Monday at 11 a.m., the Capitol Rotunda here in Harrisburg, the Protect Our Vote Coalition going to hold their press conference. You'll be there, right, Jeff?
I will be there. I will be joined by the Pennsylvania State Director of AARP, joined by Rick Bloomingdale, President of AFL-CIO, Jerry Mondesir, President of the Pennsylvania State Conference of NAACP Branches, and several others. We'll be there. We want you there, and we'll be representing the nearly 13,000 Pennsylvanians who've signed this petition that we will literally roll out in the Capitol.
Outstanding. Jeff Garris, I appreciate the time. Field Director for Pennsylvania Voice, their website, statevoices.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Jeff, thanks so much.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thanks.
All righty. Thank you. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You thought that yesteryear's threat of creeping communist cells inside the USA was the worst conspiracy in our history? Or maybe you think that foreign terrorists pose the greatest threat ever? Well, get ready to be whopper-jawed, Americans, for it turns out that the most insidious assault on the very fabric of our nation is coming from within. From a radical and subversive organization dedicated to warping the minds of our children. Yes, that devious group is the Girl Scouts. Luckily, though, our nation has such alert patriots as Bob Morris to warn that the Girl Scouts are coming, the Girl Scouts are coming. Bob, an Indiana Republican legislator, recently drew a bright line in the political sand by being the only member of that august body to withhold his signature from a resolution celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. It seems that Bob found allegations on the Internet that these supposedly innocent cookie-peddling kiddos are really a tactical arm of Planned Parenthood, promoting casual sex, the homosexual lifestyle, abortion, and, worst of all, liberal progressive politics. And in case you're one of those fact addicts who don't believe everything on the Internet, Bob offers this damning proof of the girl group's perversion. First Lady Michelle Obama is honorary president of this, quote, radicalized organization. This, he warns his fellow Republicans in a letter, should give each of us reason to pause. Never mind that Laura Bush previously served as honorary president. This is Jim Hightower saying, in bleeping credible. Only, this bobblehead of right-wing BS is not alone. At least one extremist church outfit is asking members to pray against the Girl Scouts, claiming that these kids' cookie sales amount to blood money. Well, let's just all pray that Rick Santorum doesn't discover this conspiracy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone and take the program on the go. You can also email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. How many people remember Zach Wamp, congressman from Tennessee? You know, back during the whole debate over should we let the auto industry go broke? Well, Zach said, well, we should.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
You know, I want them to learn the lesson the hard way. You know, because, understand, Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, right-to-work state, less money, less wages, less benefits in his state. And this is where, you know, look, I mean, this is why our economic plan, our policy, our manufacturing policy, whatever you want to call it, our economic development policy in this country is so screwed up. You got a congressman who probably in near his district, you got this plant. The state gave him $1 billion to build this thing. And you got him going, well, yeah, let their competition fail so they could build more and my constituents will do better. This is why having 50 individual states is a bad idea. So when the righties want to talk about, well, you know, the 10th Amendment, and Romney said it himself, 10th Amendment's one of my favorites. You know, as a governor, you want to make sure that your 10th Amendment, that's yours, because you know you could beat that, you could beat the snot out of the next state or the one halfway across the country. We can beat each other up constantly. You look at our manufacturing policy for a generation, has been basically just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic because we've been going down manufacturing-wise. Because, you know, we start beating each other up for this, you get these companies used to moving. Well, we're just going to move down there, suck up some subsidies, and as we keep moving, we'll just keep going. We'll move from the Northeast down to the South, and from the South to the South, to the South to the South, to the Far East. And that's been the whole business mentality. And we've encouraged it by giving them mass amount of subsidies. We've encouraged it by not having a federal government, willing to use the Commerce Clause and say, no, you cannot have beggar thy neighbor economic development. Stop it. You cannot have a company holding states hostage or localities hostage. You know, I think of, you know, where I grew up in Cleveland, American Greetings was in the town that I lived in. They just shook down the state this last year for something like $110, $115 million. And that wasn't enough. They then went and shook down the local government for millions more. Why? Because, well, there was somewhere down in Tennessee or Kentucky or who knows where that was willing to give them just the brightest, rosiest package. And when Obama said, you know what, we're going to save our auto industry. And, yeah, it's going to benefit these states. It's going to benefit jobs. It's going to benefit all of the suppliers. We have to do it. You had just a Republican outcry. Let them fail. You had Romney going, oh, they should go through bankruptcy. Because he knew this is where the vultures come in. This is where people like him come in. And you know who loses? Well, all the workers, of course. They lose their pensions. They lose their health care. They lose their wages. And they still lose their jobs. But the investor class, they're well taken care of. But Obama, you know, and for all of his faults, he said, look, we're going to save this. We're going to help those workers. And the UAW took massive concessions. Understand that. The righties never want to tell you that. And you've got Romney running around saying, well, they were greedy. So now you look back. You go, did Obama do the right thing? I mean, you look at the Recovery Act. It's worked. It saved jobs. It stopped the free fall of the economy. Bailed out the auto industry, gave the auto industry some loans. They've paid most of them back. And what do we see now? Well, we're seeing industry-wide, according to autodata.com, auto sales have risen by nearly 16%. On pace to sell 15.1 million vehicles this year. That's a better pace than we've seen since February of 2008. And all of them have done well. General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, much better. Why? Because they changed their lines a little bit more fuel efficient vehicles, but also they improved their fuel efficiency. People are buying these new trucks because look, at the end of the day, they're getting better mileage. Not to mention that the home building industry kind of turning around a little bit. We're starting to see more construction jobs. So as that's slowly coming back, you're going to see truck sales up. But the reality is look, you know, 4 years has made a real difference. And it's because of smart policy, sound investment, where we said, you know, okay, we're gonna help give you some money, but you're going to have to do some things. And they did. GM, the Volt. And I remember I did a TV show. I did one of the Fox stations. I did a program. I forget what the guy's name was, but I was up against a Cato guy who was saying, well, we all must drive Volt because we, you know, basically, you know, bailed out all these workers. And I said, look, this is smart policy. This is going to create jobs. It's going to save communities. It's going to get people paying taxes into their local communities, which means the schools are going to do better. People are going to have money in their pocket, which means the local businesses are going to do it. This is a good thing. And they're like, oh, you're wrong. It's all going to fail. Well, here we are. Sales up. The Volt, 70% jump in sales. Ford's, the Focus, up 114% over the year before. F-150s up by 26%. Chrysler saw one of their best years, up 40%. And you go, did it work? Absolutely it worked. And it did well for the auto industry, and it did well for the communities. You know, when I drive back to Cleveland this weekend, you know, I'm going to drive past the Lordstown plant there that you can't miss. And what am I going to see? I'm going to see that parking lot full, as I have the last several times going by there, with people back to work. And what it brings me back to is this idea that as a nation, we got to start thinking about national economic development. How do we have a manufacturing plan? And Senator and Representative Sander Levin had a piece over in the Detroit Free Press that caught my attention. And he's talking about China, who has a plan. Granted, their plan is screwing us, and we're letting them do it, by the way. Don't forget that part of it. But their plan is whatever industry they put out there, they're going to target specific industries. Think about solar. Think about all of the telecom. Think about all of the electric, the fiber optics, all of that stuff. All of those advanced technology industries that we created, that they are now killing us at. Because why? Well, they're throwing tons of money at these businesses. And in order to get access to that cheap labor, you've got to transfer technology. Explain to me what kind of corporation does that. I'll tell you what kind. The kind that only cares about the dollars and cents. The kind that cares about the bottom line in their pocket. Not this country, not our workers. Nothing to do with that. They wave the flag in the commercials, but at the decision-making table, it's all about how are we going to put the most money in my pocket right now. And those workers, I don't really care that much about. So he goes through, in his piece, he goes through this whole thing saying, look, China does this stuff. They every advantage they're going to give to their corporations. They're going to make sure that they manipulate their currency in such a way that it maximizes exports. They're breaking the rules. Our auto industry, they put up big tariffs on. They put huge tariffs on a bunch of stuff. And his solution was partially we need our government to be doing more and to have a strategic alliance so we can get some of these emerging industries, more public-private partnerships, something the DLC Democrats thrilled with, but more involvement. And if you go back and you think about what the Republicans used to preach, government-sponsored corporations and public-private partnerships, look how far the Democrats have gone. What happened to the free market? What I say we need to do is we need to stop the Chinese from cheating. Point blank. You cannot bring things into this country until you stop. We need to stop the hemorrhaging of American jobs, American corporations going to China or abroad with all. Not just with carrots. Because, like I said, our corporate masters, they've got no allegiance to this nation. Their allegiance is to the almighty buck. That's it. So what we need to do is make sure that we have trade policies that make sense. And we need to enforce the ones that we have. We need to take them to the WTO and use the rules that are there. And if they break them, we need to put tariffs on them and hold to it. You know, and I look at this situation in Findlay, Ohio, with the Cooper Tire and rubber workers. Steel workers built a great case, handed it to the government. They took it and government won. And you've got the corporation who's now kicking the workers to the curb. Why? Because their union made the company bring those jobs back. Because we're going to hold the Chinese accountable. It's just amazing stuff to me. But this November, trade to me is the biggest issue. All of this social stuff, it's about trade. That's it. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Charlie Fleming, the president of the Georgia AFL-CIO, about this Senate Bill 469. Another just amazing piece of legislation. Back after this. Well,
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Earth, sky.
The sun is now in an active part of its 11-year cycle of activity. Many dark sunspots are visible to those using telescopes and solar filters.
Space observatories are detecting brilliant solar flares, intense bursts of radiation, and our solar system's largest explosive events, lasting minutes to hours on the surface of the sun.
Occasional powerful coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are being released. They are giant bubbles of gas and magnetic fields from the sun, containing up to a billion tons of charged particles. This solar material sometimes strikes Earth. Is it dangerous? Should we be worried?
The answer, say scientists, is no. These solar storms are awesome to contemplate, but they're not dangerous to us on Earth's surface because we're protected by Earth's blanket of atmosphere.
On the other hand, very high-energy particles, such as those from solar storms, would be dangerous to unshielded astronauts in space. Solar storms can also disrupt satellites in orbit and bathe high-flying airplanes with radiation. They can also disrupt telecommunications and navigation systems.
The current solar cycle, called Sunspot Cycle 24 by space physicists, is expected to peak in February of 2013. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for solar storm. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
But you can't stop the sounds of the truth. Lock your feet, check out the Rick. What can't Rick watch me? You can't kill the process. Thank you. You can't kill the process.
Well, maybe you can't kill the protester, but you could probably lock him up. At least that's what the Republicans want to do. And you look at the party of small government, the party of less intrusive government, the party of limited government. It's amazing how much they want to use the thing that they want smaller and less intrusive and limited against workers and women and the poor and elderly and, well, basically citizens at large. I mean, isn't it remarkable? Which is why I've asked Charlie Fleming, he's the president of the Georgia AFL-CIO, to come talk to us about this Senate Bill 469, where we're evidently folks went and protested AT&T. And a week later, boom, there's a bill to make it a felony. Charlie, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate the opportunity to let the listeners know a little bit about what's going on in Georgia.
Well, I look at this Senate Bill 469, and we've talked about it for some time, and I'm going, you know, is this, first, it's unconstitutional. This idea that somehow I'm not going to be able to protest just seems completely un-American.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it takes it a step further. It is just strictly a way to try to intimidate working families and workers from standing up and trying to fight for what's right. You know, they control everything else, so now they want to be able to control our ability to at least protest.
In your opinion, because it's my opinion that this is nothing more than a way of protecting the aristocracy from us, the rabble, or the unwashed masses. I'm curious your thoughts behind it.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and you mentioned AT&T. That whole thing, the whole protest started actually from, here's a billion-dollar corporation, where the CEO makes 27 to 30 million annually, and they're laying off workers, at this time and when our country needs jobs. And they laid off 780 workers here in Atlanta. And of course, the CWA members, along with other, allies, including the Occupy movement, decided that, you know, we're not going to take it anymore, and they were going to protest. And AT&T, of course, their part of the deal was that they were creating jobs, and they have been creating jobs, but of course those jobs are non-union jobs, non-benefit jobs, no health care, no pensions, and, you know, at about half the pay. So, you know, the workers are fed up, and workers want to stand up for what is right, and they're going to fight for what they've earned over the years. A billion-dollar corporation, come on.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about a story from Japan the other day where the workers at Goldman Sachs, in Japan actually organized. They joined a union because they were being forced out the door, because in Japan, it's almost impossible to lay somebody off unless you're in economic straits. So you have to have a reason for letting someone go. You can't just, like we do here, I don't like the shoes that you're wearing, there's the door, goodbye. There you actually have a reason. So what it highlights for me is the broken nature of our labor laws, and how I hope at some point that working people across the country join together and say we need to fix these things. And I look at pieces of legislation like 469 and say this is the investor class saying we're going to keep you from doing that.
Oh, yes, yes. And you know, that's the fallacy of all this stuff. Georgia, the state of Georgia, prides itself on being right to work, work for less. You know, they pride themselves to be a business-oriented a state. So I think we rank around seventh in the country around for being friendly to businesses. The truth of the matter is we're dead last of all states, including the District of Columbia, job creation. And you know, we keep screaming as labor folks and as workers, this isn't working, folks. What you say is, the answer is just not working. It really is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. You know, we keep hearing people talking about job creators, and I found it interesting what you said a second ago about, you know, AT&T wanting to basically shifting from union jobs that have decent wages and decent benefits in the future to these, you know, these part-time or half-time or whatever you want to call them, jobs with no benefits and half the wage. And I keep hearing people say, well, we need the job creators to create jobs. And I keep asking, well, what conditions, what wage, what standard of living, what's the vision of the future of this country if the idea is we just need to be business friendly? Because I could put everybody back to work right now at $1 an hour. But can we have a society that works, and can we have an economy that's going to prosper for working people? It'll be fine for the Romneys and the wealthy folks, but what about us?
Yeah, and the same people that are screaming that we need to create jobs, and they say they'll put folks back at these low-wage jobs, then these are the same people that want to cut all the social benefits that states traditionally have tried to provide. And why are these people needing the social benefits? Because, well, they can't live on what they're making.
Yeah, and that's the point that has to be put out time and time again, because the New York Times did an article about 2 or 3 weeks ago where they were talking about that, these social safety net programs that have been under attack for 30 years by the radicals on the right are no longer for poor people. They're for folks who used to be middle class. It's just that their jobs, the wages have stagnated and actually fallen. So now just average everyday people who thought they were middle class, they're the ones who need food banks and food stamps and a little help just to make it to the end of the month.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, the thing in here in Georgia was the unbelievable thought that you would make someone a felony for standing up and fighting or protesting about their job. I mean, but they're not, I mean, they were aiming it at the labor vote, but the truth of the matter is they're aiming it at churches, they're aiming it at the Tea Party. Any organization that would step up and speak out would be penalized under this as a felony. And we had the great pleasure of having Martin King III, the son of Dr. Martin Luther King, at a press conference yesterday here in Atlanta, at the IBEW building. And you think about his dad would have been a felony probably 40, 40, 50 times over, standing up and speaking out about the injustices that are in this world.
Yeah, well, would it have only been three times in Georgia? Because as I understand, Georgia's a three strike and you're out state.
Well, yeah, that's correct. He would have only been able to do it three times in this great state.
And
then, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, then you think about it, you know, three times, that's it, that your entire life now, because you had the audacity to stand up and try to right a wrong.
But not, and you know, by becoming a felon, then you lose your right to vote. And that's another key piece in all this. You know, you're seeing a lot of this voter suppression stuff that's going on all over the country, including in Georgia. But this could be another aspect of it. You know, you're going to make somebody a criminal for standing up and protesting, and some of the points we brought up. If you're a right wing church, loving conservative, and they put up an adult bookstore in your neighborhood, and you go down there to protest, well, you're a criminal too. And people could actually lose their right to participate in this government, and which is what they want in the long run.
Yeah, they just want you to sit down and shut up. And I hope, and I'm glad to see groups like yours and people across the country saying no more nonsense. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Charlie Fleming, president of the Georgia AFL-CIO. We're talking about Senate Bill 469. So as this process is going down, and there's a whole education process that goes along with this for the general public and even for some representatives, what kind of messaging are you getting from folks that you're telling this for the first time? The people who, you know, because like we're hyper connected to this stuff, but most people, they just hear bits and pieces. So I'm curious, as you're educating folks, what are you seeing?
Well, we're saying first of all that this really is about intimidating working families, and it's about trying to take our constitutional right of being able to voice our opinion. Secondly, this is really more about politics than about creating jobs. And again, I mentioned how bad we are in Georgia, where we are about creating jobs. They should be focusing on creating jobs, and there's some good bills in our state body to bring jobs back to the state of Georgia and to our country. There's a number of hitting consequences in this bill, wanting to put a bigger burden on small businesses. Another aspect of this bill is that they actually want the state of Georgia to police a piece of the bill where businesses will have to post another poster stating that this is a right to work state. You can't, you don't have to join a union if you don't want to. And then on the state website, the Secretary of Labor or the Commissioner of Labor will have the ability to moderate and oversee this process. And on the state's website will be actual language to tell folks how to decertify a union. I mean, that's a federal function anyway, but I mean, where government is supposed to be fair and balanced, you know, not pro or con, they've just gone totally, totally to the other side. And then, you know, it's the other piece for us is it puts a real deal on a burden on our public safety. You're going to start locking up people that are protesting whatever the issue is, yet our jails, Georgia ranks, I think, in the top five in incarcerations. And so we're going to put more people in jail, even though the same Republican governor is just last week came out and saying that they wanted to revamp the incarceration process and take more nonviolent and drug folks out of jail. But then the very next day, they're saying they want to lock up folks for picketing. So it's pretty crazy. But we're getting a lot of support. We're getting some folks from the public safety standpoint. We've got a couple of sheriffs that have publicly written letters. We've got people, like I said, Martin Guy King III. We had a press conference yesterday with over 30 organizations, everybody from unions to ACLU, Sierra Club, 9 to 5, teachers organizations, Healthcare Now, a number of folks that came out and spoke out. And we'll be back at the Capitol Monday at 5 o'clock as this bill progresses. It's going to go to the Rules Committee, which is the committee that the sponsor endorsed, so we know it's probably going to fly through there, but we're going to try to get a 1,000 people or so out in front of the Capitol Monday, and then Wednesday is what they call crossover day, which is the last day, and we're doing everything we can to try to stop it by Wednesday.
Well, I hope you do, because as I've been saying about all of this insanity, the assaults on workers from Wisconsin last year, all of this nonsensical contraception bills, the ultrasound bills, stop it in the states where it's popped up, because folks here in Pennsylvania, if it passes in Georgia, if it passes in other states, you know it's coming here.
Absolutely. And let me just say one thing. As a leader in the AFL, when I go to the national meetings, I used to go and I would talk about some of the Iconian things that they're trying to do here in Georgia. And they said, they can't do that. They can't do that. Well, guess what? That was 5-10 years ago. Today, just what you just said, Wisconsin, Ohio, all these things that are going on, They've been doing it to the South for years, and it's time for all of us to step up and say enough is enough.
Yep, I absolutely agree with you, Charlie, and I appreciate the time. And as this continues, we'd love to have you or some other folks back to follow the progression of this, because we got to stop it there, brother.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and we'd love to come back anytime you like.
Great. Thanks so much. Charlie Fleming.
Thanks, Rick.
Charlie Fleming, president of the Georgia AFL-CIO. Quick break. Right back after this with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast from the website or get a smartphone and get the Stitcher app. Stitcher, and you can take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So in North Carolina, a very interesting statement by a guy in the House Select Committee to dismantle early childhood education, a guy named George Cleveland. I don't even know. I'm actually speechless when I saw this. Representative Cleveland said, "We have nobody in the state of North Carolina living in extreme poverty." And at first I'm going, "Yeah, how can you say something stupid?" And then it dawned on me, well, duh. Depends on how you define extreme or poverty. You know, maybe in North Carolina, not having food or not having a place to live or being in extreme poverty, maybe that's the norm. And from reports that I've seen, nearly 8% of people in North Carolina live in what is defined as deep poverty. The last census showed nearly 18% of the state living in poverty, making it the 13th highest ranking state in the country for poverty rates. They say that almost 730,000 people in North Carolina are classified as living in something called deep poverty. Yet, according to Mr. Cleveland, the hearing by the Select Committee on Early Childhood Education Development, nothing. Well, we don't have any of that. No, come on, there's no such thing. Tells you how completely out of touch some of these people really are. Just, you know, one of those things. It's like Santorum. You know, I remember Santorum saying, well, you know, if people just got married, they'd stay out of poverty. So maybe those 730,000 people that are living in deep poverty, maybe they're not married. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe the Republicans are right. If we just got those poor people to marry, then they would not be poor. I mean, it's kind of an interesting statement. Wow. But the zeal for marriage that we see out of the right wing, especially out of Santorum, well, a straight marriage, that is, not that gay kind. Kind of interesting, because if you look at the rate at which the straight marriage fails, I don't know that you can really defend the institution all that much, but they do. And from what I've seen, and the research, not my research, but research that's been done on the reasons why marriages fail, the number one reason, money, generally, socioeconomics, the fact that, you know, we don't have enough money to put food on the table. You're both busting your behinds trying to make ends meet, and at the end of the month, not enough to pay the rent or not enough to put food on the table. Or, hey, I can't buy school clothes. Sorry, kid, can't have shoes. That causes conflict. So I've always said the number one family value should be the right to join a union, because then you might be able to afford to pay the rent and put shoes on the kids' feet and maybe alleviate some of those money problems. So I look at all of these massive cuts and all of this stuff, and it just goes, you know, money problems. What's that going to do to the people at the bottom, the folks at the margin, especially when you're talking about education? You know, we hear people talking about, well, we can solve education. All we need to do is cut teachers and, you know, we need better teachers. It's a teacher's fault. And I keep saying it's socioeconomics. It's the fact that, you know, the families are struggling to make ends meet. Kids come to school without breakfast, not ready to learn. But the righties say, no, no, it's not that. No! Teachers are the problem. Education is the problem. Just like in Wisconsin, where the guy on the Senate Committee on Public Health and Human Services and Revenue said, and I'm just amazed at this, he proposed a piece of legislation. His name's Glenn Grotham. He has proposed amending the current law in Wisconsin, which states, promote statewide educational and public awareness campaigns and materials for the purpose of developing public awareness of the problem of child abuse and neglect. That's what the law says currently, that they're going to promote it statewide. We're going to educate the public on the issue of child abuse and neglect. What Mr. Grotham wants to add to this, and I'm just not making this up, he says, in promoting those campaigns and materials, the board shall emphasize non-marital parenthood as a contributing factor to child abuse and neglect. So if I'm getting this right, single parents are the reason kids get neglected. Single parents don't love their children as much as married parents do. The second part of it. Current law says disseminate information about the problems of and methods of preventing child abuse and neglect to the public and to organizations concerned with these problems. So we're getting out, we're informing people. He wants to add again, in disseminating that information, the board shall emphasize non-marital parenthood as a contributing factor to child neglect and abuse. And you go, well, wait a second. Your voting record, You voted to cut all kindergarten programs for four-year-olds. You've decided that you want to do a whole bunch of really ugly, nasty stuff for kids. Aren't you the one we should be legislating against? For instance, he introduced a bill that would have changed the state law retroactively to eliminate some 173 children who were lead poisoning victims. Is that not child abuse? Shouldn't we be going after him? Can't we amend the law and say, in disseminating that information, Glenn Grotham is the reason why some of these kids are getting abused? It's just nuts. But these righties, man, these extremists, they have this frame. And everything has to fit into that narrowly confined, very small little sliver of their brain. And everything else as well, it's probably the teacher's fault. As Newt Gingrich has said, the teachers are to blame for same-sex marriage. Which is, I find kind of really amusing, since I think it's his sister that's gay. Evidently the teacher's the fault for her being gay. That's right. Evidently there's a growing acceptance as the younger generation grows up and goes, well, you know, who cares? That's not important. He thinks it's the teachers who have done this. He says, ultimately, understand, Newty's a 10th Amendment guy. Newty's a smaller, less intrusive government guy, a limited government guy. Here's his quote. I think ultimately we're going to have a federal amendment, because at the rate we're going, you might be able to pass a federal law, but at the rate we're going, it's going to be just chaos. You're going to have some states in that say it's all right and other states that say it's not all right. And he's pointing, of course, to Maryland, that just passed and signed the right for gay people to marry. And hey, you know what I say about gay people getting married? Good luck. You're probably going to need it. Because if gay marriage is anything like straight marriage, half of you are going to fail within the first 5 to 7 years. So, but good luck. You know, all in favor for you. You know, I've always said maybe these radicals, maybe the Santorums and the Gingriches and all of these people who, well, I shouldn't put Gingrich in there, because Gingrich has failed 3 times. He's kind of blowing the average. But, you know, you would think that these people who are pro-marriage, and I guess Gingrich is pro-marriage. You know, 3 times he got married, so he did it 3 times. You know, that's, like Limbaugh, I can see how that's pro-marriage. It's that staying married part that I guess they're not pro. But anyway, if you wanted to save the institution of marriage, I'm all in favor of it. How about conditions that are conducive for families to stay together? You know, like decent wages for workers, like education for kids so that, you know, it doesn't cause a strain on the family. How about health care so that you make sure that the family unit is able to stay together? A lot of those programs that I think that, you know, the New Deal tried to put forth to help families stay together and cope. You know, I don't hear the righties talking about that. You know, I'd be okay with, you know, doing away with, you know, some abortion, putting some restrictions on. If by forcing women to have children, we said as a society, we're going to help take care of them. You know, you were there too. You're part of this. Granted, she's doing all the work, but you just had a little fun, but you're going to have to pay for it too. I don't see any legislation being pushed for that. I don't see it at all. And I don't see any legislation saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to do this. And father, you're going to be the guy who's going to help make sure that the kid gets educated and raised properly and has health care and opportunity and all that stuff and love and nurturing and all that. Instead of pointing fingers, especially, and you know who that Grotham guy was going after. He's going after women. It's another one of these moments where we're assaulting women and making them want to, you know, it's okay for men to go out and sow their wild oats. That's okay. But, you know, women, evidently not. Evidently, we still think of them as second-class citizens. Or at least the Republicans do. Quick break, right back after this.
God, right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Arizona AFL-CIO Thursday organized a day of action at the state capitol in Phoenix against six anti-worker bills pushed by right-wing Republicans. Several busloads of union members and supporters carried their message to politicians at the Arizona capitol. Arizona AFL-CIO spokesperson Rebecca Friend says corporate politicians are pushing these bills, scapegoating working families to fulfill their extreme right-wing agenda to the detriment of schools and the health and safety of Arizona communities. Police and firefighter unions are among those opposed to these bills. The anti-union bills are being backed by the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity. The bills attack public worker unions as part of a nationwide assault on the rights of public workers in a calculated strategic move designed to destroy not only the on-the-job rights of public workers, but their power to fight back politically as well. The former director of security at the Upper Big Branch Mine will serve 3 years in federal prison. Huey Elbert Stover was sentenced for lying to federal agents and destroying documents sought by investigators probing the 2010 disaster that killed 29 miners in West Virginia. The case focused on Stover's role of giving the mine advance warning of safety inspections, which allowed cover-ups of bad safety practices. Mine Safety and Health Administration investigators said that played a major role in the disaster at the mine, formerly owned by Massey Energy. Will Connecticut's minimum wage soon be close to $10 per hour? Jesse Russell reports.
Currently, Connecticut minimum wage workers earn $8.25 per hour, which comes to roughly $17,000 per year for a full-time minimum wage worker. According to the federal government, the poverty level for a family of four is $22,350 in total annual income. That number has been used by advocates of raising the Nutmeg State minimum wage to $9 per hour in 2012 and $9.75 per hour in 2013. According to the legislation seeking those increases, the state's minimum wage would be tied to inflation starting in 2014. A study presented during recent hearings on the bill found that there is no correlation to the claim that increases in a state's minimum wage leads to job losses. Connecticut is one of 18 states that has a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
One of those things that I'd like to go back to and have gotten right at the beginning of the Obama administration. Would have been nice to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed through. Sure would make things a lot easier and a lot better for workers today. I'll tell you that. Because, you know, you look across this country and you see the massive amounts of lockouts. You see the number of employers going, well, opportunity's good for us to take back some of those wages. Opportunity's now perfect for us to throw some more work on you. So we can reduce the number of people that we need, and by the way, a little bit more profit. You look at Wall Street. Wall Street is fat and happy. CEOs, they're as happy as they've ever been. Why? Because they have sufficiently made us in the working class thankful that we have a job and willing to hand back some of the hard-fought gains, which is why when I see stories of folks across the country saying, you know, no more. You're profitable. We want a piece of that. I got to get him on the program, which is why I've asked Sophia Edwards. She's a 10-year blood collection instructor at Red Cross in Cleveland to come and talk to us. Her and 225 members of Local 507 there in Cleveland are on strike against Red Cross, a company that, you know, $2 billion in profits off of what she does. Sophia, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. I understand on Valentine's Day, you guys took to the picket line.
Yes, we did.
That's one of the our bigger drives that we have here in Cleveland every year in Landerhaven. They estimate approximately 800 to 900 pints of blood they collect that day.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, like any strike, like any action, it comes down to wages, hours, conditions. What's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is that our contract has been expired since May of 2011. You know, we've been at the negotiating table since then. Negotiations broke down in February when, you know, they wanted to offer a health care plan that was just totally outrageous with the cost. They don't want to give sufficient wage rates. They are not giving us the staff safety and the donor safety that we're asking for. And, you know, it's basically, you know, the 200-plus members here was like, enough is enough.
You know, I talked to a couple of folks that have, you know, I used to, when years ago, I worked at Red Cross there in Cleveland as a security guard. And I remember folks like you and others who were working, you know, just outrageous number of hours.
Has
that improved at all?
No, it has not. You know, there some of, I mean, we cover 19 counties. Okay, so, you know, people in all the areas, they do traveling, and some of our days are consist of maybe 14, 12-hour days. And, you know, throughout those days, in regards to donor safety and staff safety, you know, management has taken the standpoint that in order to process donors, you know, we are to go without lunches or breaks. So you're talking about people that get up maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, work those long hours, and the expectation is, okay, you process those donors and you get them through
and don't make a mistake.
Lunch or a break.
And don't make a mistake. I mean, well, 14 hours, I got to be honest with you, Sophia. If I'm sitting in that chair and I've given blood over the years, the last person I want stumbling towards me is someone who's dead on their feet with a needle, because I hate needles to begin with. But I can't imagine someone who's, you know, who's at the end of the day, who's not even had a break. That's gotta be a problem for safety.
Absolutely, and that is one of the concerns that we voiced at the table. The problem is that they don't want to be held accountable or have anything written in our contract which holds them accountable to make sure that there is adequate staffing, enough staffing to accommodate the donors. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when we do make a mistake, okay, we get disciplined for it. And to call down to management, you know, their attitude is, you know, just lump it. You know, we've had management make those statements to us, you know, grin and bear it, lump it, do what you can, you know, get through the day and make a mistake. And a person is sitting downtown called in for a meeting and they're looking at a final warning for a mistake that could have been avoided had there been proper staffing. Not only the potential of hurting a donor, and when we do make a mistake, that impacts the product.
Yeah, I look at this, and I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine being the person with the needle or even the person behind the wheel, somebody not being able to, the people you text, your drivers, working those kind of hours without any type of break, any type of lunch or anything. That just, I can't believe that that's even allowed legally.
Well, we can't believe it either. And, I mean, and that is one of the reasons why we are on the picket line.
So let's talk about this for a second, because the idea of safety now is in my head. You know, I can't imagine that their fines or any type of judgments against them for accidents that may happen. I can't imagine that not giving you a lunch isn't cost giving you a lunch isn't cost beneficial to them, because I think we've proven through the last 100 years that when workers take a break, when they get lunches, they're more productive and they make less mistakes. I really just can't fathom this.
Well, let me tell you, this is an organization that has been fined by FDA for millions of dollars. Most recently, they were fined about $10 million in regards to their inadequate system for distribution or receipt of the products that we collect, an inadequate quality assurance system. I mean, they're basically an organization that feels that, okay, we're going to do what we want to do. I mean, regardless, the $2 billion, I mean, they have the money to sit up there and to pay it. And basically, you know, they want to skimp off at the frontline staff which is the collectors, and, you know, give management and the CEOs and, you know, all these people that are higher up, you know, and just continue to fill their pockets.
What is, but, what is Red Cross's CEO make, if I can ask?
Oh, man. Which one? Okay, our CEO, he makes about $600,000. What Gail McGovern makes, I mean, she's got to be. I mean, she's the top. So I'm probably close to $1 million.
Wow. For Red Cross, really? That is just, I got to be honest. You know, I had thought maybe $150,000, $200,000, $1 million to be the
CEO. I mean, that's. If our CEO is in that, I mean, she's top dog, so you can imagine. And that's one of the things that we don't understand. They are an organization that can afford to do better by their workers. I mean, this is all over the country. I mean, you have a lot of regions that are working without contracts due to the same issues, the health care, the wages, donor safety, staff safety, you know, just their blatant, outright disregard for their employees that do the work.
That's just mind-blowing to me. So let me ask you this. As you've been on strike, you've been out on the picket line, you've been going around the into the 19 counties, as you pointed out, raising awareness. What kind of reception are you getting from folks? What kind of messages are you getting back?
Well, actually, you know, we're getting a lot of support, you know, from communities. We can always have more. A lot of people don't understand that Red Cross is basically two entities. They have their blood services and they have their disaster services. So disaster is what people are more familiar with, that, you know, when tragedy happens, they're the ones that are out there, you know, giving support and food and shelter and everything else. Blood services is the part that collects the blood, which Red Cross sells to the hospitals. So, you know, when people see us out there, their main question is, you know, well, we have to kind of let them know that, okay, we're blood services. Okay, we're the part that collects the blood. As far as disaster services, you know, they're a separate entity. They're still out there, you know, helping people the way they have done for years. But the awareness, and we've had a lot of people that have a lot of years of service there.
Right.
Okay, so we have developed a rapport and a relationship with our donors. So when we're out there, we'll have our donors. The area that I was just out at today in Ashland, you know, we had donors that know the workers that were out there on the line coming up to them and, you know, showing their support. So, I mean, our donors miss us, and we miss our donors, and we want to go back to work. But we cannot and do not want to go back to work under the same conditions and, you know, and to accept what Red Cross is offering us in regards to our contract.
And not only that, you want to protect the, you know, and like most nurses and most people who work in the healthcare industry, you want to protect the folks that are your under your care or that you're working on. And that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of us, you know, we've had the have situations where, unfortunately, you know, our family had to receive that product. You know, we've had, you know, family members that got that product, saved their lives, or gave them a little bit more time to spend with us. So, you know, that connection is there. You know, the employees that work there, okay, we believe in the mission. We believe in what Red Cross stands for. And, you know, unfortunately, management does not, but, you know, they're constantly in in-services and meetings that we go to. You know, we sit there and we look at different slideshows and presentations on, you know, how much we make a difference. But when the tables is turned and we come to them, their whole thing is, you know, be thankful you have a job or get another job.
Yeah, and that's you know what's amazing to me about that is, and I've heard that statement by so many workers recently. I talked to the folks out of American Crystal Sugar in Fargo, North Dakota, who told me, you know what, they had us in for a big breakfast, gave us shirts, told us it was the best year ever. We're the reason that the company's so successful, and then the next day they locked them out. I'm hearing the same thing from you. Hey, we're successful, we're doing well. Thank you, you're the reason. Oh, but by the way, we want to cut the staff. staffing. We want to cut your pension, your health care, your wages. Thanks for the hard work, but we don't want to pay you.
I mean, our union, you know, offered a medical plan that, bar none, is going to save costs to the members. I mean, we signed a petition with over 90% of the employees signed it to let management know that, you know, this is what we wanted. And why would they not? If we were so valuable and such an asset to the organization, you know, allow us to have decent health care where, you know, we can afford it.
I absolutely agree with you. What's the next move, and how can we help? Because at the end of this, there's got to be pressure put on these folks. What can we do to help you, Sophia?
Well, you can you can come out to Cleveland, support us. You know, our brothers and sisters out there, not only in the Teamsters Union, but in other unions that have gone through it. I mean, we're out there on the line. We would absolutely welcome you coming out and joining us to show us support. I mean, you can contact our local union, you know, for support. I mean, anything. I'll even call Red Cross and tell them, look, you know, these are good people. You know, come on back to the table.
Absolutely. Sophia Edwards, I appreciate the time. Anything we can do to help along the road, you've got a friend here at the Rick Smith Show. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate you listening, and thank you very much.
All right, let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You thought that yesteryear's threat of creeping communist cells inside the USA was the worst conspiracy in our history? Or maybe you think that foreign terrorists pose the greatest threat ever. Well, get ready to be whopper-jawed, Americans, for it turns out that the most insidious assault on the very fabric of our nation is coming from within. From a radical and subversive organization dedicated to warping the minds of our children. Yes, that devious group is the Girl Scouts. Luckily, though, our nation has such alert patriots as Bob Morris to warn that the Girl Scouts are coming. The Girl Scouts are coming. Bob, an Indiana Republican legislator, recently drew a bright line in the political sand by being the only member of that august body to withhold his signature from a resolution celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. It seems that Bob found allegations on the Internet that these supposedly innocent cookie-peddling kiddos are really a tactical arm of Planned Parenthood, promoting casual sex, the homosexual lifestyle, abortion, and, worst of all, liberal progressive politics. And in case you're one of those fact addicts who don't believe everything on the Internet, Bob offers this damning proof of the girl group's perversion. First Lady Michelle Obama is honorary president of this, quote, radicalized organization. This, he warns his fellow Republicans in a letter, should give each of us reason to pause. Never mind that Laura Bush previously served as honorary president. This is Jim Hightower saying, in bleeping credible. Only, this bobblehead of right-wing BS is not alone. At least one extremist church outfit is asking members to pray against the Girl Scouts, claiming that these kids' cookie sales amount to blood money. Well, let's just all pray that Rick Santorum doesn't discover this conspiracy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline closes at our heads. Everything's raising but the wages.
Oh, yeah, you look at this and you go, maybe, hey, there, that's what Red Cross probably wants, some minimum wage people, maybe $1 an hour. How about we just get rid of the minimum wage, that pesky minimum wage. Make it work, you know, like the good old days, 20 hours a day, sun up to sundown. Just amazing. I got an email during the break. Dave writes, I'm a tech driver. I work 10 to 14 hours a day without a break or lunch. And Jim sent the email saying, as these people are in charge of the nation's blood supply, are you kidding? AIDS and other blood-borne diseases prevention, criminal treatment for employees. Oh, incredible. Andy sent the email saying, that's effing outrageous. Just outrageous that a nonprofit CEO would make that much. $600 to $1 million? It's way, way over the top, Andy says. Too much for a nonprofit manager. These CEOs across the board are complete. Well, you fill in the blank. He said, I'd never give a dime to an organization rewarding their CEO with a salary over $150,000. Andy says, I'm with you. Just too much for the organization CEO that's supposed to be representing. And it is. I think it's outrageous. If she's making that much money, anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million a year, really? Something that's supposed to be for the common good? I think that's far, far away from the original intent of what Red Cross was supposed to be. And, you know, I remember when I worked there at Red Cross years ago. I was a security guard in the disaster area. My job there was to deal with people who needed emergency assistance. Because some of the caseworkers were getting beat up, and this was the building was really in a crummy part of town over on a Prospect. You probably don't know where that is, but it was a crummy section of town. And I remember those people were sorely underpaid. The people who did the outreach were poorly paid. But the CEOs weren't making that kind of money. They were putting the money into their services, and they moved to a Taj Mahal building and. Well, I guess it's all gone straight downhill from there. And it's like a lot of the charities, these nonprofit people with this DC mentality. We're so much better. I'm telling you, folks, we are definitely seeing the splitting of America. And John Edwards, for all of his faults, was spot on right. There are two Americas. There's the CEO class, there's the wealth class, and then there's the rest of us. And what the CEO class and the wealth class has always done masterfully is divided us, sliced and diced and kept us at each other's throats masterfully. And you look at these big PACs that are coming out now and all this money that's going in to funding these four idiots running around wanting to be the Republican nominee. And it's remarkable to me that it's just, I guess our politic has turned into now presidential candidates are just puppets for the billionaire class. You look at this Foster Freeze. Remember him, Mr. Bear Aspirin? Oh, when the gals were young, when I was a young man, they just put Bear Aspirin between their knees. And yeah, somebody should slap him. When I was a kid, they probably would have. But, you know, he's been out there pushing this radical agenda. And who's he doing it through? Santorum. Listen to Santorum's rhetoric. And Politico had a really good piece on the moneyed folks behind the four people. Santorum's alive because of Freeze and a couple other billionaires who have put money into this red, white, and blue fund. And, you know, with Freeze, one of the big things is this idea of Islamic extremism and Sharia law, which is why you hear the insanity coming out of Santorum. And as I was reading through the article, it turns out that Freeze has been a financial backer of Santorum since 95. Gee, we didn't know that, did we, Pennsylvania? So it could explain why in 2006 Santorum went completely nuts with his whole anti-Islamo-fascist stuff and all of that. And, of course, got him creamed by Casey. But you look at this and you go, it's all about the money. Look at Gingrich. He's got billionaire casino magnate Sheldon Adelson funding his campaign. $20 million he donated to Gingrich's Winning Our Future Super PAC. Why? This guy, I think, wants us in war with Iran, so they keep pushing this. He's somebody that's been funding Gingrich since the 90s. And you go, you know, what exactly you want, Sheldon? Well, he wants to move the embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And Gingrich has said his first executive order is to do that. And you wonder, you go, So explain it to me. The money that Adelson's giving to Gingrich, that's not buying his support. The first thing he's going to do is do exactly what Adelson wants. Don't you have a problem with that? You know, I look at Peter Thiel, Ron Paul's guy, the guy who pulls Paul's strings, co-founder of PayPal. He's donated a couple of $1 billion to the Endorse Liberty Super PAC. And you got this guy who wants, his idea is this thing called seasteading. And I had to look this up when I saw the reference to it. This is where he wants to drop away from politics altogether. He wants to have his own little libertarian world, either in cyberspace or outer space, or settling the oceans, according to seasteading. We're going to have these autonomous libertarian little colonies that are floating, which is kind of interesting. I'm not sure what the Paul bots, what Paul has said, but the Paul bots seem to like it. Again, Paul not so out about it. But this guy Thiel, he goes to these Bilderberg meetings, and I'm sure everybody knows about the Bilderbergs. They're the folks who want to dominate the world. They, you know, they get a couple hundred people together and they decide how they're going to slice and dice the globe. And they're secretive, and you have to be invited, you know, with a secret handshake and all that. Now, this guy goes to this, and he is concerned that there are people out there who want to rule the world and want to plan the world's activities. He's one of them. He's one of them. Just nuts. And then look, this other guy, William Doerr, big rich guy, gave $1 million to Santorum's PAC. Why? Why, yeah, why would this guy just give him? Well, because he's Catholic. That's it. That's the whole reason. Because he's out there pushing the radical version of Catholicism. It's not about the issues. It's about how to get as much money as you can into these PACs to push your agenda so that you can be president. But at what cost? And I keep thinking about this. At some point, we the people, we the working folks, folks who have struggled and really been harmed by this collapse. When the Bush collapse happened in September 2008, you didn't see Wall Street jumping out the windows. You know, when the Great Depression happened, you saw people jumping out the windows. They lost their fortunes. They knew they were screwed. But our Wall Street folks, our captains of industry, our investor class, they knew they were going to be okay. Because they knew they had bought and paid for enough folks in D.C. and in regulatory agencies that they were going to be taken care of. The sky was not falling for them. In fact, most of them saw it as an opportunity. Now all this stuff collapses. We get all the suckers out. We get all that pension money. We get all those working people's money that we've been telling over the years. Get your individual stock trading accounts. Put your $5,000 in there and gamble that away. So we've done that, and what's it gotten us? it's gotten us nothing. They were fine, and they knew they were going to be fine. It was us who got screwed. It was you and me that got screwed in this. And while I find it amusing, I find it really, really sad. And at the end of it, folks, we need people who are going to stand up and fight for us. People who are going to defend us. That simple. Let's quick take a break. Let's quick take this call before we go to break. I got Robert on line one. How are you doing today, Robert?
I'm doing great, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
Oh, you brought up seasteading, which is hilarious.
Tell me about it.
Well, before I even get into that, we have to talk about Minerva. I know you got to go for a break, but Minerva was an atoll off the coast of Fiji that the libertarians tried to claim as their own as a country in about 1974. And they were running on pure libertarian philosophy of just the natural order. The natural order of things would just kind of settle everything out. And the Fijian soldiers ended up coming in and taking the island back by military force, kicking their asses off the island, which is hilarious. It's a great statement for libertarianism.
That is pretty good. I thought when I saw the seasteading thing that, you know, this is just insane, but it's what I would expect out of the Paul bots. The people who tell me that there's nothing, freedom is being able to go into a hotel and puke in the lobby and trash it and destroy things, because that's freedom.
Yeah, they had their own currency. You can look it up on Wiki. It's got a good write-up on it. But the other thing they're thinking that they're trying to move towards is an offshoot of the sea setting where they have these abandoned oil platforms that can move throughout the ocean. And, of course, the protection of naval militaries to keep the pirates away from them is very much implied that they'll accept that protection without paying anything for it in order to survive. But it's just a ridiculous concept. It really, really undermines the whole idea of the foundation of libertarian thought. It's an affront.
Yeah, well, I thought it was funny, but I appreciate the information, Robert. Thanks so much.
Great job, Rick. Thank you.
Give me a call anytime. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world.
The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
The sun is now in an active part of its 11-year cycle of activity. Many dark sunspots are visible to those using telescopes and solar filters.
Space observatories are detecting brilliant solar flares, intense bursts of radiation, and our solar system's largest explosive events, lasting minutes to hours on the surface of the sun.
Occasional powerful coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are being released. They are giant bubbles of gas and magnetic fields from the sun, containing up to a billion tons of charged particles. This solar material sometimes strikes Earth. Is it dangerous? Should we be worried?
The answer, say scientists, is no. These solar storms are awesome to contemplate, but they're not dangerous to us on Earth's surface because we're protected by Earth's blanket of atmosphere.
On the other hand, very high-energy particles, such as those from solar storms, would be dangerous to unshielded astronauts in space. Solar storms can also disrupt satellites in orbit and bathe high-flying airplanes with radiation. They can also disrupt telecommunications and navigation systems.
The current solar cycle, called Sunspot Cycle 24 by space physicists, is expected to peak in February of 2013. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Solar Storm. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. David sent me an email during the break pointing out that the CEO of American Red Cross, Gail McGovern, $1,032,022. $1 million compensation package. And we're going to cheap the people who make the money. The ones who bring it in. We're going to cheap those folks on the front line. We're going to understaff. We're going to underpay them. I just keep scratching my head, but it doesn't surprise me. Anyway, thank goodness for Arizona Sheriff, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We are going to evidently be talking about the birther thing for more time. I thought this was done. They got their puppet out there doing more. Anyway, for more information, what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, and before I get into my stuff, then I'll just do a quick diversion. Former Romney campaign chair.
Former?
Sheriff Arpaio.
Yeah, former.
Yes,
because he's insane.
Yes, yes, but Romney did call to get his endorsement, I understand.
Yeah, that's, well.
This time around.
We know Romney will do whatever he thinks is going to get him a vote. Yes. Say anything, do anything. Maybe not light his hair on fire. I think whatever he's got in there, keep it from that anyway. Anyway, what's going on around the world?
Well, going on around the world, very interesting. We got our first of three reports, three probes that have been going on into the U.S. service members who burned Korans at a NATO base. So we got our first report back. Military investigators have included that five soldiers and an Afghan-American linguist were involved in the incineration of this pile of Korans and other religious holy books last week. And they say basically what happened was that the soldiers removed the Qurans from a prison located at Bagram Air Force Base after they were found to contain extremist messages. The books were then placed in an office for safekeeping. Then they were mistaken for garbage and taken to a landfill on the base. Afghan employees identified the books as Qurans just as their pages caught fire, which is a major desecration according to Muslim teachings. And then that discovery led to a week of unprecedented attention and, of course, huge riots. So U.S. military officials said that although the five soldiers will be reprimanded, it's unlikely their names will be released or that their punishment will approach the seriousness of what some Afghans are demanding, including trial in an Afghan court. However, they're probably loose ranks, but however, there are two more investigations ongoing. There is a joint U.S.-Afghan military report, which is going to give probably a much more detailed explanation. And then there is another investigation. This is the third one, conducted by the American military alone. And that's the one that could ultimately lead to criminal legal action or lesser administrative punishment. And we should get those findings in the second half of this month.
Another reason for me to say we need to gather the sheep and get the flock out.
Well, and that's what's also very interesting that's going on here, because they are trying to make a deal for a long-term military presence in Afghanistan. And they're trying to make this deal between the U.S. and Afghanistan before a sort of unofficial May deadline, because there's a NATO conference in Chicago then. And the hopes that they can do it are fading because Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, is not prepared to compromise on two demands. One is Afghan control of jails, and the other one is an end to nighttime raids on Afghan homes. And Western officials say, well, the first one's not practical, basically because they say that the Afghans don't know how to run the jails. And the second one would compromise the military effort. And the negotiations have dragged on for over a year. So basically, things are grinding to a halt, and this is not where they wanted to be, sort of a month and a half out of a big NATO confab coming up.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Again, I'm a big fan of let Harmad have his four little blocks there, and let him deal with his problems. What's going on with Iran and Israel? When does the bombing start?
Well, we don't know. We do know that the president gave a pretty feisty interview to The Atlantic magazine in which he said, I think that the Israeli government recognizes that as president of the United States, I don't bluff. I also don't, as a matter of sound policy, going around advertising exactly what our intentions are.
I agree.
But I think both the Iranian and the Israeli governments recognize that when the United States says it is unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, we mean what we say. Now, he said he would take no options off the table, but he was more explicit. He said those options include a military component after a list of other steps, including diplomatic isolation and economic sanctions. Why is all this happening? This is all happening because Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is coming to Washington. He's going to be speaking at APEC on Monday, the president speaking there on Sunday, and the two of them are meeting on Monday.
You know what I find interesting is you've got all these, you've got the final four there in the Republican side of this thing running around saying that the president's weak. You got the Republican Party saying, oh, he's weak on foreign policy. We've lost. I don't know how that's helping the nation.
Well, there are many people who would say that it's not helping the nation, and that this kind of thing doesn't help in terms of how it gives our perception to the rest of the world. And certainly Netanyahu is very aware that it's an election year, and that's factoring into how he's handling the Iran crisis.
Yeah, we will see. What are your thoughts? Where the Netanyahu Obama talks are going to go?
I don't think they'll go very far. I think they will be very frank and very blunt. And I'm glad I'm not in the room.
Because I understand Iran's voting today to, I'm assuming, just basically rubber stamp what's already gone on there.
Yes, they've got candidates, although the candidates were all vetted, and so it's for a new parliament, basically. Any moderate who wanted to run has been screened out.
Or shot. Or beheaded, since they still do that. So the big thing here today, as if we've got nothing else to talk about, is this idiot Lindbaugh, this stupid comment that he made. And he made it for one reason, that's to get attention, and he got a lot of attention. But the president has weighed in on this. I guess he called the girl.
He called Sandra Fluke today and thanked her for publicly backing the administration's policy requiring health insurance coverage of contraception for women. Yes, he did.
So I've been asking the question today, you know, how much more of the Republican hand do they have to show? I mean, last February, the attack on workers. Now we're seeing the attack on women. In Georgia, they want to attack just basic citizens, make it a felony for people to protest. How much more of the right-wing lunatic fringe playbook do we have to see before we go, the Republicans have just gone off the complete deep end?
They want to make it a felony?
Yeah. Senate Bill 469.
Really?
Yeah, well.
That's kind of fun.
Well, it's unconstitutional, but hey, that never stopped Georgia before.
Wow. Oh, my God. My
All righty. Anyway, yeah, it's one of those things that makes you go, yeah, they are actually doing it. They are actually making sure that it is a felony that you're basically stuck on. And lastly, Victoria, what do you got for me?
The FCC is considering whether police should be able to black out cell phones.
Well, of course they should. Why not? I guess just yesterday they ruled that they can look at my numbers whenever they feel like it. Why can't they block them out?
Yeah, that was a federal appeals court. Well, the FCC issued a request today for public comment for 60 days on whether government agencies should be allowed to block access to cell phone networks. This stems from an incident last summer, you remember this, when the San Francisco Transit Agency shut off the transmitters that allow for cell phone reception in four underground subway stations to disrupt a planned protest over a police shooting. Well, the protest never materialized, but the cell phone disruption led to weeks of protests and several cyber attacks on the transit agency's website.
Yeah, I mean, and understand the premise behind this. The same idea with the internet kill switch. It's so that if we, the rabble, the unwashed masses, if we decide that we don't like what they're doing and we want to protest, they can shut off all of our communications and then throw us in jail. And the great thing about Georgia, it's a three strikes and you're out state. So if you get caught three times protesting, you're done for life.
Wow.
You love Georgia. Hey, and the great thing about blocking cell phones, I won't have to listen to that guy in front of me on the bus.
You know, that's not a bad reason to be in favor of this, then.
But they arrested the guy today, yesterday, I guess they arrested a guy who actually had one of those phone jamming units.
Yeah.
Because he was blocking the cell phones of the people on the bus because he didn't want to hear him either.
Oh, so you can't really that, then.
It's not okay for him, but it's okay for the man. Victoria Jones, always great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science, hope. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a
ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast from the website, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So Pennsylvania is not the only state, and in fact, there are a lot of states across the country who are cutting, punishing poor people and students and workers, going down that path and making sure there's plenty of tax breaks, plenty of handouts for the wealth class, the business community, all of those folks, make sure that they're funded. The state of Idaho has had three straight budget cut years slash and burn budgets. And I saw this report from the Spokane Review, or Spokesman Review, who said a $36 million tax cut for Idaho's top earners is roaring through the Idaho legislature, backed by the governor and co-sponsored by a majority of the members of the House there in Idaho. Republicans understand that to be. The bill would lower Idaho's top individual tax rate from 7.8% to 7.4% and lower the corporate tax rate from 7.6 to 7.4. That would take $35.7 million out of the state's tax revenue next year and every year thereafter. Now, they've been gutting education. They've been gutting health care spending. In fact, they have gone and slashed their higher education budget back to 2001 levels. They've cut millions from mental health funding, and it's just another part of the, the cut, gut, and punish. You people down at the bottom, you, the rabble, the unwashed, you working people, you need to pay. We need to reward the captains of industry, the titans. And, I look at this and I go, at some point, I'm looking at all these cards that keep falling out of the GOP hand. We have got to stop being divided. And they keep throwing these nonsensical issues out after us. Oh, it's gay marriage. And I look at this principal in West Tennessee, a high school there in West Tennessee, where the principal was evidently giving an assembly talk. And she said that, it's almost shocking to me. Well, I guess not. I guess it's not all that shocking because she turned around and she said, anybody who shows any type of physical contact, you're going to be suspended. 60-day suspension for public displays of affection for you gay people. And any of you people who are lesbians or any of you pregnant people, you're going straight to you know where. And you pregnant people, your lives are over. And I'm going, this is the principal saying this. She has now stepped down and resigned. But, it's this mentality that you go, at some point, do we not have to blow back against this? Now, remember, Gingrich is saying that the teachers are the reason that the schools and the kids are accepting are accepting others. Evidently not in West Tennessee. And now you've got Ken Nelman. How many people remember the name Ken Nelman? Anybody? He was the guy who everybody during the Bush years knew he was gay. I mean, you look at him and go, yeah. Denied it the whole time. He was Bush's reelection campaign manager, the head guy there in 2004. Went on to become the RNC chairman. Well, he came out in 2010. Now he regrets not doing more. Now he kind of regrets not doing more during his time in the White House and not standing up for others. Well, I guess better late than never, right? I mean, give him credit, he's trying, maybe. No, anyway. In Utah, the great state of Utah, you would expect insanity to come out of Utah. Evidently in Utah, acting sexy is now illegal. If you flirt or you're, evidently that is now illegal. Their rationale being that, well, you know, prostitutes, they make policemen prove that they're not policemen by touching themselves or somebody else. And we just don't want that anymore. So anyone who acts in a suggestive way, a lewd or suggestive nonverbal acts, we're going to arrest them because we want Christian version of Sharia law. I mean, isn't that really what we're talking about? I mean, it's just mind-blowing to me, every one of these pieces of legislation. Women, are you ever going to wake up? When's the revolt? When's the revolution? You're the majority in this country. Understand that. Stop being divided. And I think some of this is coming towards that. And I see this coalition of 51 women's groups called Her Votes. That they're finally fed up, they said. You know, look, at the end of the day, we need to be talking about, and this is what they're saying, we need to be talking about income inequality, we need to be talking about the wage gap, we need to talk about the access to health care, access to pensions, access to all of the things that education, labor, you name it, that haven't gone into the public forum. And I think now is a good time for this. Because we're seeing the Republicans' hand. They're showing it. They want to push women back into the 1880s, 1890s. And I would be okay with that since I am obviously a man. That would be a pretty decent world to live in. Yes, sir, you serve me. As I've said in the past, you know, my only problem with that is I've got two daughters. And I don't want them to live in that world. So not a good direction to go. But I'm hoping this election... And the Republicans, I think, have stepped in it and stepped in it in a big way because, you know, they've always been the party of wanting the things that we're talking about. They want to take away contraception because they know that it's going to put women back into the kitchens barefoot and pregnant. They've always talked about destroying workers' rights because, you know, those workers shouldn't sit in the same restaurant. They shouldn't go to the same theater. You know, I remember my grandfather telling me, look, this labor has got to be destroyed. Because it's gotten too much for too many. He said, you know, when I went took your grandmother to the theater and we sat next to my boss, that was the end of it. He didn't want to sit next to me. He didn't want to have dinner in the same restaurant. Look, the investor class, they don't want to see us. They want us to clean up after them. They want us to take care of them and to produce them wealth, but they don't want to see us. Only if they can lock us in a closet like that woman in New York. That decided there was an immigrant woman that she wanted to work for, locked her in the closet. That's what they want. Keep us around like pets and then discard us when they're through with us. Understand that. And they're going to spend a ton of money to keep us at each other's throats so that we don't wake up to that reality. And I'm really kind of confident. I'm actually looking forward to the next couple of months because I think their agenda has come to the forefront. I think people are finally starting to see who they really are. The mask is off. And I think a lot of it has to do with the money that these billionaires are pumping into these candidates. Do you really think that Santorum wants to do this class war, this culture war thing? Do you really think he wants to put his true views out there for women to go, oh my gosh, this guy's a Neanderthal? Do you really think that he wants that? No. The Foster Freezes of the world, the billionaire club of the world, they're pushing him into this. I mean, he'd like to say it, but he knows he's going to lose. And look, I mean, look at Michigan. He was up at one point by, what was it, 30 points? And he loses? Because the people there got it. They understand. And we better do something and better do it quick. Because the insanity will not stop. Anyway, this weekend I'm going to be heading to Cleveland for a funeral next week. I'm going to miss Monday's show. We're going to run a repeat on Monday. I apologize for that. But, my best friend's mother passed away yesterday, and I'm going to go back for the funeral because she was always wonderful to me. And it's sad. You know, as you're getting older, things like this happen. But it's a sad occasion, and she was just a wonderful person, and she will be missed by her family. But I will be in Cleveland for that. I'm going to stop off at the Red Cross picket line and say hello to those folks, take some pictures, bring those back. And hopefully I may be there for a bit of Super Tuesday. I'm hoping to be back here Tuesday before the program. But on Super Tuesday, one of the big things popping up is the gerrymandering of the districts in Ohio that is going to pit Marcy Kaptur and Dennis Kucinich against each other. And, you know, I hate to lose either one of them, to be honest. I love them both. You know, when I was a kid, you know, back in the mid to late 70s, I handed out, you know, flyers for Kucinich running for mayor of Cleveland. I like Kaptur because, look, you know, she was the very first person to come out and say, don't leave your house. Don't leave until they show you the proper documents. Don't go until they show you the note. Because she knew right from the beginning this MERS thing was going to take off. It was going to be a massive headache, and it was going to be a massive screw job. And she said, look, don't let them intimidate you. Don't let them throw you out until they have the proper paperwork. And then, you know, a year later, we find out just how screwed up it is and the whole robo-signing and all of the criminal activity that went on in this. So I don't know where I would vote, to be honest with you, if I were in Cleveland right now, because I like them both, and I think they're both terrific, and it's going to be an absolute shame to lose one of them. So I'm hoping to see more of that. And some of the, you know, the big names have popped in. Tom Hanks has jumped in. He's a Kaptur supporter. Willie Nelson jumped in. He's a Kucinich supporter. A whole bunch of people. Ned Beatty, Warren Beatty, not Ned. Ned's the other guy. He's jumped in. Russell Simmons has jumped in. Whole bunch of people for Kucinich. So it'll be interesting to see where we go on Tuesday. But we're going to be back here as soon as I can. I apologize again, but unavoidable. Can't miss that. Anyway, if you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it from the website at thericksmithshow.com. Today we talk with Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future about Romney and his insanity. We talked to Jeff Garris, field director of the Pennsylvania Voice, about the Senate House Bill 934, the voter screw job bill here in PA. Georgia AFL-CIO President Charlie Fleming was here talking about the Georgia Senate Bill 469, which 69, I guess, is a, well, anyway. We also talked with Sophia Edwards, a striking worker out in Cleveland, works for Red Cross. And my mind's still shocked. Over $1 million for a CEO of a nonprofit. That is just amazing. Anyway, I hope you have a great weekend. I hope you stay informed, stay in touch. Of course, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, or if you've got a smartphone, Stitcher. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here next week.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming. Today, we'll
in the midnight sky.